And a very good morning to you. Welcome along to Tuesday morning's OTB AM. We're here with you all the way until about 9:30 this morning. We've got a very, very busy show for you. We're going to talk to one of the people involved in Becky Lynch's WWE career, just at that precise moment that maybe it looked like she was turning her back on wrestling. Our guest this morning helped her to get her gig with WWE. That's coming up after 9:00 this morning. We're also going to hear from Nigel Owens, who's been in town for the launch of the Union Cup. He's been speaking with Adrian Barry. We'll bring you that around about 8:30. We'll give you the sports news, but we're also all day here in the company of none other than the myth, the legend, the man, that is Kenny Cunningham. Good morning to you.
All day?
All day.
That wasn't in the contract.
Well, you're allowed
at least for an hour this morning, and potentially I might dip me toe in this evening.
Oh, you got that.
The rest of it, forget it, I'm gone.
Morning, noon and night, they call it.
Definitely won't be here to noon.
It's this time of year, you were just saying, reading through the papers there, that there's a lot of good football today, tomorrow, this week, and for the rest of the season. It's that period of the year where all the crap you sit through in November and December finally pays off.
Yeah, balances the scales. Yeah, definitely in relation to the Premiership run-in, what's happening in Liverpool and Manchester City, it's pretty obvious. Even those Champions League places where previously I might have thought, come on, really, Champions League third, fourth spot, can't get generally too excited about that. I think this year it's exactly the opposite, with Chelsea, Spurs, Arsenal, and Manchester United. I think that's a fascinating race as well. And then obviously Champions League on top, a dollop of that on top, the English involvement, some fantastic matchups this week, Manchester City and Tottenham in particular. I think there's a lot of kind of little subplots as well going on there as well. Tottenham's new ground, which will be interesting. So yeah, fantastic. Even Championship, I'd reference playoff places, people scrapping, you know, absolutely killing each other.
About 12 teams within 6 points of the playoffs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, one of the best decisions they ever made, I think, in the Championship in terms of introducing the playoff places. Yeah, so fantastic run there. So yeah, I can't get enough of it, to be honest. Like you said, 4 weeks, pretty much as well. We're second week of April. Yeah, just sprint finish now, so should be great.
One part of the other subplots is obviously who's going to end up playing where next year. We saw last night a performance for the ages from Eden Hazard. I thought there were bits of that game where he just reminded me of Maradona in 1986, where he was just getting the ball and everybody else were sliding in with tackles, leg breakers, and he's just pulling it back from them, drifting forward, feinting. Now, one of the runs came to nothing, but I didn't care. I actually didn't care that there was no end product. I was just like, yeah, okay, you can do that. I'm happy if I'm at that game that I've paid money to see you do that.
Yeah, at his very best, which he has been at various stages this season, particularly start of the season, he started the season in that type of form, Jeremy, actually blew people away. People thought, well, this is it now. He's arrived, he's matured, he's reached that stage now. We're going to get that level of consistency from week in, week out. This is why potentially he's going to be the kind of heir apparent in Messi, Ronaldo. He's got to be talked about in those terms. And then suddenly, just when you're patting him on the back, that bit of a dip. He had a little bit of a dip mid-season when the Sarri loving kind of fell apart a bit, and suddenly his form dipped a little bit. Sarri, and rightly so, question has added a little bit his personality, his leadership qualities within the dressing room. He just feels as if that little bit of a sulky mode clicked in on him, which has always been the case. Always been around him a little bit, Jared, in terms of whether he can maintain that level of consistency week in, week out when it really matters. And now he's kind of flipped the gears again, and end the season he looks as if he's finding that form, which is why it'll be sought after in the summer. A lot of talk of Real Madrid coming in, which I can understand. But for me, there's always got to be that slight doubt about him because of that. Obviously, I don't know him well, but from the outside looking in, I'm that bit of a personality in terms, that little bit of maybe sulkiness, a little bit of sensitivity at times, any type of criticism. You know, we hear him sometimes in interviews, I don't care what anybody says, I don't care what the manager says, don't care. But when I hear that type of thing, I always feel as if that's somebody a little bit, you know what I mean, claiming not to be affected by criticism, but actually internally is a little bit.
Yeah.
So that'd be a very small concern for him maybe going forward. But when he's at his best, you're right, yeah. And his individual style, that low centre of gravity, that explosiveness, change of direction.
It's great to watch.
It is great to watch. It's very hard There's very few defenders I think could actually deal with him in 1v1 situations. Not too many, because even your physical attributes have to be the same. I think you have to be that traditional fullback, that low centre. You almost got to match him in those respects. You can't be 6'2", long legged, great athlete. You know, Lilian Thuram, those type of defenders, modern type of fullbacks. Even those would find it very difficult against him. You know what I mean? So he's great to watch, like you say. And last night as well, we got another taste of it. So yeah, in full flight, as good as there is around, just not enough of it during the course of the season for me.
It will be interesting to see where he ends up. The other thing that is going to be interesting to see is how Ole Gunnar Solskjaer deals with his first transfer window proper, where he's the one who is hopefully influencing things. A lot of Alex Ferguson in his... he's talking a lot about Alex Ferguson at the moment. How do you feel about this?
Every moment, not at the moment. Yeah, I don't mind it to a point when he first came in. Let's get back to the old Manchester United. Ferguson was a big mentor, and of course... Alex Ferguson was. I learned a lot from Alex. I'm sure he did. But yeah, look, he's got the job now. It's all about. I'd like to hear him talk about. This is my vision for the club. This is how I see it. I haven't quite bought into the. I'm going to take us back to the Manchester United way of playing. I understand. No, I can't say I don't know what that means. I do know what it means traditionally, how the team he played in, 4-4-2, bit of natural whip, back to front quite quickly, didn't overcomplicate the game. Plenty of crosses into the box, good combination, players committing themselves into the box, high energy, that type of football. I think generally speaking, when people talk about the old matches, I think that's generally what they're talking about. But even that, Jerry, changed under Ferguson. Their last 4 or 5 years under Ferguson, Queiroz came in, playing more of a counter-attacking style, 4-5-1, particularly in Europe, you know, soaking up pressure a little bit and maybe counter-attacking teams a little bit. So even that changed a little bit, even when Ferguson was there. And certainly, when I've watched Solskjaer, and I've been impressed tactically how he set the team up, but at times it has been that very much counter-attacking style as well, in terms of hit them quickly.
Isn't that a bit of genius on his part? So Van Gaal said that Solskjaer was basically doing fairly similar stuff to what he and Mourinho were doing, but he's getting away with it because he's a Manchester United legend, that actually it was that counter-attacking style of football. They were parking the bus when they needed to. If you're Solskjaer and you realise that that's how football should be played, you're telling everybody one thing, you're doing something different, and you're getting away with it because you're channeling the gods of Alex Ferguson and using that as your shield.
Yeah, but I think it's a bit different than that. I think it's actually assessing the quality of the players that you have at your disposal and saying, right, which style of play best suits these players. And you look at that Manchester United team, the kind of pace and energy that they have on the team. For me, that's a classic counter-attacking.
Yeah.
So have they got the players in midfield to get on the ball and actually dominate? Is Matic the type of player now who's going to get on the ball in tight areas and get you through and get you up the pitch and get Pogba on the ball higher up the pitch? As good as Matic is being, probably not, like, you know what I mean? Whereas you look at them at the moment, you look at the team, the attributes that they have, the likes of Lingard, Rashford, Martial, Lukaku, the ability to hit quickly from back to front, and that counter-attacking style we're talking about is best. So I don't necessarily feel this the way he wants to play, but certainly at the moment when he looks at his players, he probably thinks this best suits the player, so I give him credit for that.
Yeah, that bodes well. We did want to talk to you a little bit about the Manchester United nostalgia that is sweeping over the land at the moment, because Ole Gunnar Solskjaer keeps talking about Alex Ferguson. So we got some photographs of you here, Kenny. We can have a look at this. There you are, up against Cristiano Ronaldo.
Yeah, now for the purists, I'd criticise myself there because I'm actually tackling with the wrong foot. When I played a lot of the time at centre-half, I played left side and I was predominantly right-sided player, so you'd see a lot of this. Generally going into a tackle this side of the pitch, I should be sweeping that ball away with my left foot. Yeah, naturally Vertonghen would come in there and naturally sweep the ball away with his left foot. So that's, from a technical point of view, that wouldn't be a great tackle, though it looks as if... Is that a straight yellow card these days?
You've got the ball.
Stud shown, a bit of the ball, but obviously momentum, potentially.
Red these days, couldn't it, Kenny?
I don't think my other legs is in contact with the ground, so
okay.
I'd argue probably free kick and yellow card in today's game.
Did you ever win at Old Trafford? Do you remember?
Yeah, I had a pretty miserable record. Oh, forget about Old Trafford. Old Trafford, Anfield, I'd throw in there. The London club's not too bad. I remember Chelsea, Arsenal, maybe Not even Spurs, actually. That was pretty miserable as well. But no, Manu, I remember getting a draw up there in an FA Cup tie, stealing a draw, last-minute job, free kick, super dons, picking them off and getting a draw. But apart from that, it was tough. The tough place to go for obvious reasons.
Because of Alex Ferguson and Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
Oh, because of Alex.
Yeah, so here you are with Solskjaer, yeah. That's also in the Birmingham days, isn't it? We've only got the end of your career here, obviously.
Yes, the Birmingham, not exactly sure. Was that, my head looks a little bit, he may have actually put the ball in the top corner at this stage. That looks as if that's almost a bit of a pat on the back. Don't beat yourself up over that one, lad. He's probably put it through my legs and put it in the top corner.
That happened to you, yeah? Was Solskjaer good?
Sure. He was a brilliant goal scorer. And yeah.
When you were up against him, did you think, oh shit, here comes Ole Gunnar Solskjaer?
Yeah, but he was one of those players that never frightened you, because he hadn't got that kind of real athleticism, that kind of explosive pace. Physically, he wasn't going to intimidate you, but his movement was brilliant, and obviously he was a brilliant finisher. So the type of player, when if he came off the bench and came up against you, you weren't thinking, oh Jesus, no.
Yeah.
Whereas the likes of Giggs and another, and there was other players there. For me personally,
there's Giggsy.
Yeah, there's Giggsy. Is he actually holding? Got a bit of my jersey.
He does.
He's trying to slow me down. He's trying to slow me down a bit there, Jer.
He is.
Have a look at the hair. Have a look at the.
Both
is. Chat with Mrs. about that last night. She was saying, oh, hair was all over the place. So. Maybe it was a little bit. Maybe
she lamenting times past when you had some. Is that it?
Now the young flame made mention of the fact about me hair or something. So that's how the conversation started. He's something about daddy with hair or something. That's how the conversation started. But yeah, he was the opposite Giggs, because he'd be the opposite. Now he would terrify me in terms of his pace and his trick. You're talking about Hazard not getting yourself in a 1v1. Giggs would be the same. I'd need to get me right side midfield and alongside me right side of centre half across when I was playing.
Yeah, because you're right back at that stage. Yeah.
Yeah, it'd be kind of a collective effort.
You were never a centre back at Wimbledon, really, were you? Were you always a right back?
Yeah, mostly a right back at Wimbledon. My early years, I went back to there. Wimbledon, maybe my last couple of years, went back into the championship. My last year, went back at centre half.
Yeah.
It was more of a natural position for me, but I enjoyed fullback because when I had my legs, I'd get forward a little bit. But it did get you a little bit more isolated against the opposition winger. Certainly, in those days, maybe nowadays we're so used to seeing wide midfielders drop back into orthodox full-back positions. Yeah. Yeah, and full-backs getting that little cosy position between winger and
centre.
Yeah, right on the fillers in my day, if you'd have said to them, yeah, get back along, so just get into an orthodox right-back position, they'd been like, nah, I don't think so.
That's not my job.
You deal with him, yeah. When we won. That's what you're paid for, yeah.
Yeah, very good. Have we any more photographs? Yeah, so here's Ruud van Nistelrooy.
Even he's got a hold of me. No, he hasn't got a hold of him there.
Oh yeah, you're holding him. It's the secret. You're trying to make it look like he's got
and
hold of you.
And he was another one in terms of that.
Yeah, trick.
Not particularly frightening, yeah, athletically, pace-wise, but he was the first one I saw Van Nistelrooy take that offside position. We're so used to, now centre-forwards actually stand offside and will stay behind you. So you're squeezing to the halfway line. Normally when you squeeze, you'd say, squeeze them up, push them towards the halfway line, and then they'd come into a position where you could see them and the ball, they'd be in your peripheral vision. But he was the first one I saw actually stayed behind you in an offside position, so you couldn't see him and the ball, and it was really off-putting. And what he did was, at the last minute, he dived back onside and kind of go again. And I remember first seeing it, thinking, what's he doing there? But it was really unnerving, because you couldn't see him. So there was a bit of nervousness. He'd instill a bit of nervousness across the defensive line. So
this is just really the rule change happens where you were either offside or you weren't, and then it was, are you interfering with play? And that's is around the same time.
Yeah, a little bit. This is a long time ago, though. The rules are still the same. If he got the ball in offside position, he was offside. But what he wouldn't do is he wouldn't stand in a position where you could see him and the ball. So where if he made his run, then maybe you could block him off, your body would be between him and the goal. He'd stand the other side of you, and at the last minute maybe just take a big step. He'd actually nudge you. He'd actually nudge into the back of you and push you under the ball. And then, which is the last place you wanted to be. You always wanted to be goal side, yeah, as a defender. But he'd stay the other side, and when you went to react, he'd knock you very subtly, give you a little body.
So that's genius, isn't it?
Doesn't sound much like, but it was the first time and after that, a lot of players used to do it. Henry used to do it, and quite a few more. It's quite prevalent now, like you're saying, in terms of the whether he's offside or not. That's a last ditch as well. That looks like I'm wrong. So,
so this is
that looks. That's a classic. Right, I've got myself wrong, so I'm not going to win the ball. Just make a nuisance to yourself. Get your elbow into his ribs. Just, you know, for anything that'll actually put him off.
Rooney's athleticism would have been something that terrified people. Here's Roy Keane at the end of his career dribbling through Mario Melchiot. Who's that on the left? I don't know who that is.
Damien Johnson there, Northern Ireland international. Yeah. Well, I got a Joe Kinnear done. We went up to Manchester once, and don't ask me why. I was playing right back for Wimbledon, and during the week, Joe said, "Right, I'm playing you centre midfield. Just stop him getting on the ball. Can you just try and put him out of the game?" And he brought in a young lad at a right back, reasonably inexperienced to play in an orthodox right back position. So it lasted about 15-20 minutes, I remember. Not because maybe I was particularly, Roy was necessarily bossing the show, but our young right back was getting twisted a bit by Ryan Giggs in those 1v1 situations that we were talking about. So I was ejected from that central midfield area, which I was actually quite enjoying.
Sliding doors.
So I was watching the kind of impact Giggs was having the first 5 minutes, thinking, thank God I'm not in my normal right back position.
But you could have been one of the world's great man markers. There you go.
But funny enough, Roy left one on me about 5 minutes before that. Anyway, I was kind of for a sliding tag with Roy. He kind of left it just does. Had half a dead leg anyway. So anyway, long story short, I ended back up at centre half, having been put into a kind of a man-marking role on Roy. Nobody would have known it was a man-marking role. It only lasted 15 minutes. I ended up limping back into the right-back position after the dead leg Roy had given me, having to face up to Giggs in those 1v1 situations. Thankfully, I think we're about 2-0 down at the time. So
it didn't matter.
Yeah. The game was over.
All right, let's bring you through what's coming up on the show this morning. We're going to speak with Phil Thompson around about 8:10 to preview Liverpool against Porto, one of the most previewed games that I can remember for a Champions League quarterfinal. Everybody's just assuming they're going to win. Nigel Owens around about 8:30 this morning, the sports news at 8:40, then some more Nigel Owens, and talk about Spurs new stadium and their hopes for the two legs against Manchester City with John Duggan around about 8:45, and a bit more to come your way as well later on. If you want to get in touch with us, use the hashtag OTBAM. You can get us on twitter.com/offtheball. Just subscribe at Off The Ball, and anytime we go live, turn on your notifications and we'll ping you. It's the same on youtube.com/offtheball. But the best place to get us is actually offtheball.com every morning. You can just hit the watch or listen button there, and we can be a radio show or we can be a TV show for you. Whatever you want of a breakfast morning. Now, time for the papers. Okay, so we're going to start with the Times Ireland edition, and the FAI stories are on the front and back pages of all of the newspapers again this morning. The front of the Times Ireland is FAI cast doubt over explanation for €100,000 Delaney loan. We have advised Sport Ireland that recent public comments made by the FAI did not accurately reflect the board's level of awareness of the existence of the €100,000 payment to the association in 2017. So the FAI are saying that the statements they issued themselves did not accurately reflect what the board knew in 2017 at the time of these proposed loans. So that's all becoming a bit of a mess in advance of the FAI's appearance before the Oireachtas Committee tomorrow. FAI duo want Delaney out. This is the first time we've seen this story. This is from Gary Doyle and John Fallon. And it says that two members of the 10-man FAI board now want Delaney to stand out. This is important because it's the first time that that board has ever appeared fractured. And as Gary Doyle and John Fallon point out, that if four more say they want him to go, then that would be a majority and he would have to go. Carberry set to miss the semi. Joey Carberry is likely to miss Munster's Heineken Champions Cup semi-final against Saracens, but Leinster hope Johnny Sexton will face Toulouse. He's got to prove himself in fitness this week. Sterling, the racist win if I walk off. So that's that continuing story in English football at the moment about what is an appropriate response to racist abuse from the players. Klopp last year was real pressure. This season is fun. I mean, do we buy that? Because Klopp looks like he's under a bit of pressure sometimes on the touchline. Naming deal lands Limerick €300,000. Limerick GAA Chiefs and LIT have signed a 10-year deal worth €300,000 to rename their county ground as the LIT Gaelic Grounds. Carberry highly unlikely to make Saracens semi-final is Roy O'Connor's story on that one. And the front page of the Irish Independent for you there. Now the FAI casts doubt on Delaney's €100,000 loan. What have you got for the back of us there?
It's not quite the back, is it? We had this conversation.
We'll do the back first and then we come back.
Oh, you're doing the back first?
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
We're obviously dominated by the Liverpool game this evening, plus Spurs and Manchester City. Son gets a mention, probably one of the stars of the Tottenham team this season. He's going to play a big part over the two legs. I have a strong feeling. I don't you might ask me what a strong feeler means, but I think Spurs have a real, real chance in this game against Manchester City. That must seem an obvious thing to say, but to the point, I think they can turn Manchester City over. New stadium as well. The atmosphere in there is going to be absolutely electric. I think that can really lift this Spurs team. I think it's going to be cracking. So can't wait for that. Hazard gets a mention as well. I'm amazed at 100 million. Price tag on Hazard. It used to be an argument before, don't let a player get the last year of his contract, otherwise you have to end up giving away 2 years, extend. Once that kicks in, once he starts, the contract starts whittling down 2 years, forget it, you're going to give him away for peanuts. He'll have a year left in his contract this summer. Yet it looks if they're going to get close to 80 to 100 million pound for Hazard. It's amazing.
It's the new 5 million.
It is. I don't quite understand. I mean, if I was in Eden Hazard's position, the temptation is to allow your contract to run out and pocket that 50 to 100 million yourself.
I think players are stupid. I think footballers who don't let their contracts run down are stupid. You're rich enough now to afford insurance. You go to the insurance company, you go, here's £1 million, here's £2 million. I'm insuring myself against an injury that's going to prevent myself from getting a massive payoff. And the insurance company goes, yeah, we'll take that. You're going to run your contract down and we're going to get our money back. Everybody's happy. Just run yourself through
maybe
your contract
it's because,
down.
Maybe it's because, the money he'll receive anyway, he's vastly wealthy. He's going to, even if he moves in the summer for 100 million, there's still going to be a huge amount of wages. But the obvious argument is, you move in a year's time, that 50, 75, 100 million, which Real Madrid, a lot of that is going to be diverted to you. Yeah. But you would think that's a strong bargaining tool for, it just shows the money that's in the game clubs, in the club's coffers now, that even if Hazard's agent goes to Chelsea and say, you better let him go now this summer for 50 million, 40, because you're not going to get nothing next summer. They're like, not bothered.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. We've got 300 million sitting in the bank. No problem to us. So clubs now add that 30, 40, 50 million, which clubs couldn't afford to write off previously or whatever it is. Now the bigger clubs or whatever, we'll keep him. He'll generate that amount for us anyway.
It doesn't make good business sense. We'll come back to that, the papers, in a minute, because I want to talk about that Liverpool game. As I said, it's curiously quiet, certainly in this part of the world. Phil Thompson joins us on the line at the minute. Phil, there's a sense that Liverpool fans just expect to go through against Porto, and it's the quarter final of the Champions League. There needs to just be a little bit more nervousness and tension, I think.
Do you know what? I totally agree. I've just been thinking that this morning, just been having my breakfast, and I was thinking that this is not the way it should be. This makes me a little bit more nervous. Normally, as you know, with those Liverpool fans, social media stuff, the rallying the troops, everybody's getting ready. It's a big game, quarterfinals, Champions League. Let's be ready. And I'm going, oh my goodness, we need to get up for this. And I'm certainly hoping the players will be. And Jürgen and his staff, they have to maybe sense it, feel it, and go, come on, lads, we've got to get and try and get them up for it. Because as we've seen of late games when Liverpool should be winning, we've not really turned up as we should be. And we're just getting through. I think this is absolutely huge. These portals should not be taken for granted at all. And you have to be ready to meet it head on, because it is the champion. Yes, it was a good draw, but you have to be up and ready for it and motivated.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's the good draw. Porto come out of the hat and everybody thinks, oh yeah, well, it was either them or Ajax. And then Ajax still has that little weird sense that maybe you don't really know what a team that young are capable of and they don't know themselves. But because there's the experience of last season in this group and in this squad, that must give you some confidence that, notwithstanding the fact the fans probably are a little bit complacent, surely the players aren't.
No, well, you'd like to think, no, just to explain that, the players have got to be, listen, what a fantastic run it was last year. And, you know, we had sort of Manchester City in the quarterfinals, and my goodness, you're seeing what that was like and how everybody was motivated. And then we had Roma. What a good team they were. That was semi-final, so everybody was sort of ready for it. But this one, it just seems to be so sort of, even in the papers, everybody's talking about Tottenham, Manchester City, how big, even the Manchester United game, which is a day later. And this game is absolutely massive. So what they gained from last season, that motivation. Yet they may have been just bigger names in the realms of European sort of big teams, I think Porto have to be given massive respect and be ready for it. Now, I've been there and played in these games, and you've got to be ready for it. One thing I must say, guys, is that I think we need to get back to a clean sheet. I think, and this is maybe the game, the last three games, we've conceded a goal in them. Everybody's just took it, oh, well, it's been all right because we've won the games. Well, I think we've got to get back to that habit of making sure. And I think if we can get a result tonight with a clean sheet, a good result, a 1-0, a 2-0, I think that will be suffice because I do see us scoring away.
Phil, interesting, you're talking about defensive solidity there, and I suppose when you speak of those terms, not just about the defensive line, it's about that kind of protection that you get from that midfield three in front. Obviously, as a former Liverpool centre-half, I'd be interested in asking you, if you were playing that Liverpool, as one of those Liverpool centre-backs, who would be the midfield three that you would like to see in front of you? Klopp's got a number of options with the players who have come in this season. Fabinho's been a little bit in and out of the team. Henderson's come back in. Who would be the three, ideally, you'd like to see in front of you? Maybe in terms of have that real kind of defensive mindset and would give that back for that little bit more protection that you're talking about in terms of keeping those clean sheets.
See, this is one of those games where everybody, you would like to think, oh, well, it's like Southampton. You thought Lallana wasn't even on the bench, but I was thinking Lallana plays or Shaqiri plays. That little bit of creativity from one of the three. But when it's come to European football, and this is what I'm saying to you, is that we have to treat these with respect. So I think he'll go with a three, sort of a solid three in midfield. Everybody was clamouring for Fabinho to come back in. How can he have not played in the game before Southampton? He needs to come back in. He played against Southampton, didn't have the best of games, and everybody's gone a little bit quiet on him. I like Fabinho. You've got to sort of, you can't play great every game. You have to know what your players possess in them. And I think he really gives it solidity. He's a good player as the whole midfield player. He can look forward more than maybe from that position what Jordan does. But he's got this great height presence as well, which he can shield the two centre-backs. And it's good in both ends of the box. So I would go for Fabinho. Now then, you see what Jordan, I always like Jordan Henderson, just seems to be the go-to man when anybody wants to give a bit of stick. He's the scapegoat. He's the one. I would play him to the right-hand side of Fabinho. And let him go, because what he does, he possesses great energy. Let him go and close people down, win the ball high up. He can do that all day. As he said after the game, he needs to get in the box more.
Yeah.
And the other one will be Wijnaldum on the other side, because I think he's a footballer's footballer, Wijnaldum. I think he's a really good, intelligent player.
Yeah, you can trust him, yeah.
Kenny, what do you think is going to happen here?
No, I'd agree with Phil actually in terms of that midfield three. I mean, Henderson, people got so used to seeing playing at that holding midfield position for Liverpool. Yep. But if you remember when he first burst onto the scene at Sunderland, I was there at Sunderland last year, Phil, in professional football. Jordan was 15 years of age and he was playing right side of a midfield four, and he was an attack-minded player. I remember watching him play in training and he was looking to get into the box. He hadn't got that defensive mindset, so his natural inclinations to get into the opposition box, and he has the legs to do that. He's kind of disciplined himself to play more of a holding midfield position at Liverpool, and people automatically assume he's a holding midfield player, but he's not. As a young player, he was actually an attack-minded midfield player. You've mentioned it there, the game at Southampton. We've seen a little bit of that. When you take the shackles off him and you put somebody in the team to complement him, like Fabinho, who's prepared, disciplined enough to sit behind the ball, he was actually happy to do that and allow the likes of Henderson and Wijnaldum, potentially Kate in the future, to get forward and hurt the opposition team in the last third of the pitch with those front three. That for me is more of a happy balance that Phil's talking about. Fabinho just sitting and the likes of Henderson giving him a little bit more freedom to get himself up and down the pitch.
I agree, because you look at your Jordan's got, he's probably got the most energy out of all our midfield players, probably most of the squad. He can keep going for the 90 minutes quite easily. But you're right, when Jordan first came, even at Liverpool, he played wide on the right before all these different formations was, certainly before the three. And he was there because every year you go when he first came, you're like, well, what can he do? Well, the one thing that Jordan could do was get up and down that touchline. Yeah. He wasn't a winger. But what he could do, he could whip the ball in. He was a great deliverer of the ball from that right-hand side. That was probably his forte before everybody understood that he had great energy. And I think we need to utilise that, not just give him one game of being allowed to sort of roam free, get forward. Because it's one thing that our midfield has lacked, has been that goal-scoring prowess from anybody. I'm not quite sure how many goals we've actually got. It's not a great deal. But that was one of the good things about Southampton. Keita got on the score sheet. Out of the three goals, Keita gets on the score sheet, Henderson gets on the score sheet. Two sort of centre midfielders, if you want. And that was a real good plus point from Friday night.
Can I just ask you one last thing? Shaqiri seems to have disappeared as a late game option, and a lot of the Liverpool fans are wondering, did something happen? Is he not fit? Or what's going on?
I really don't know. I don't know what happened to Henderson Lallana on Friday night. You know, he's really come back in and made a big impact. He's one of those sort of that you can do it. You can go two holding midfield players, him in the middle, and then the three boys up front. But Shaqiri looks as though his darts fell out. The only thing I can explain, guys, is we're not privy to what goes on the training pitch all the time. As we know with Shaqiri at Stoke, he sort of blazed a wonderful trail when he first came into the Stoke side. He was doing everything, busy everywhere. But then when he got settled in the team, he wasn't that same player. Maybe I'm wondering if he's not training well enough. And I think Klopp's like that. You have to train as you will play on a Saturday. And if you don't, you're not in the side. And he can be like that, Klopp. And I something tells me that he's not been training well enough. Because he's quite, as you just said there, he was that go-to man 15, 20 minutes from the end. This fella can turn a game for you. This fella, you can put him up, you can score a goal. He's got an assist. He can take a great set piece. But he's not been using them. So something tells me, he's still been on the bench of late. Something tells me he's maybe not training as he should.
Phil, give us your prediction. What's going to happen?
I think we're going to win 2-0 tonight. I will have that clean sheet and we'll score two. And I think, as I said before, guys, next week I'm quite sure we can score away from home as well.
Good stuff, Phil. Enjoy the game. Thanks a million.
Cheers, Phil.
Cheers, lads. Nice to talk.
It sounds about right. That's what should happen, right? But yeah, there's just this kind of weird sense, I don't know. And it's completely irrational. It's not based on anything. It's not based on the fact that Liverpool aren't playing well, because they are certainly well enough to beat Porto over two legs. But it's just that there's like a...
You're just contradicting yourself, basically. You're trying to make an argument, but then you're shooting yourself. Are you getting that sense? I'm not getting that sense, to be honest with you.
It's the indigestion you have about the Spurs game. That's what
No, I think the sound football and reasons why Spurs could get the better Manchester City. If you want to listen to them, I can't make that argument for Porto. I just don't think the mentality of this Liverpool team, I don't think it'll be a case of, you know, underestimating Porto, not quite turning up on them. This is quarter final of the Champions. They're in the Champions League semi final. If they get this job done tonight, they're as good as there. So you know what I mean? So I can't imagine there'll be any kind of lethargy with the Liverpool team. And just the tactical setup, I think, is absolutely fascinating. And going forward for Klopp, for me, the interesting thing is this kind of midfield three. I don't think he'll sacrifice it, because, you know, it's not as simple as that in terms of patterns of play, the whole thing. He's committed to this system of play.
Well, answer the question you asked, Phil. If you're a centre-back, what three do you want?
Well, I tell you what, I've no problem dispensing with that midfield three. When Fabinho came into the football club, I thought potentially Klopp was looking at an orthodox midfield two, if Fabinho and Henderson playing as a two, and that number 10 coming in to the team, whether it be Lallana, Shaqiri, whether it be Firmino playing off, Salah playing in there, but just flipping that midfield three into that kind of triangle. So you basically got two sitters. Now, I'm not saying Henderson has to sit there for the whole of the game, but he can still spring forward from that position. But for me, at times, Fabinho and Henderson sitting as a two in there, if I'm a centre-half, I want to see that a two in there sitting 10-15 yards square of each other in midfield. That's the kind of the defensive protection I want. Very easy for those two to get across the pitch and shuffle across and double up a fullbacks. So he's at least with Fabinho coming into the team, he's got that option. I think it will be a three, and I've no problem with that midfield three there. Fabinho, Wijnaldum, Henderson slightly in advance, and those two getting themselves sore. Because Wijnaldum's got goals in him. When he first came to the club, he was scoring goals from that midfield position, getting into the box. Very good header of the ball, Wijnaldum, arriving into the box. Very strong header. So he's got goals in him. Henderson certainly has, for the reasons that we've said, but we haven't seen it because he's playing the holding midfield position. So that midfield three, I have no problem. But going forward for me, in terms of people talking about that lack of creativity that Liverpool's not, that's the answer for me. Fabinho and Henderson, you could argue Kate if he finds a bit of form as one of those, an orthodox midfield too, and then get that fourth attacking player in behind those front three, and then you take your pick, whether it's Lallana, Shaqiri, whether you go out and spend potentially another 40, 50 million pound pair and bring that specialised number 10 in. But that's a big transformation in terms of how your team plays there, and Klopp's never really committed to that. He likes that midfield three in terms of how he goes to press, high energy. Doesn't like flipping and playing with that orthodox 10, but it's an option he has now with Fabinho coming into the squad.
Because he's the holding midfielder of the future.
Yeah, he's got an orthodox centre with those defensive attributes. I mean, I don't think that even Henderson, for me, naturally hasn't got that. He's disciplined himself to play that role at Liverpool.
Yeah, but
it's not naturally. He didn't come up that way in youth team football, just sitting in front of the back four, just letting other players get home and sliding across, making tackles.
He doesn't have the range of passing either for that position.
I don't know. I think that's I disagree with that. I think he's a better passer of the ball. Yeah, I think he's a better passer of the ball, Jordan, than some people give him credit for. No, he hasn't got the range of passing as a Pirlo and other orthodox playmakers in that area of the pitch. But his other attributes, that kind of athleticism, box to box, getting around, making tackles, disrupting things, keeping things simple.
Yeah.
That's why he's in the team week in, week out. That's why Klopp always leans towards him. But it's whether going forward you utilise that. I don't think he utilised Henderson's greatest strengths in a whole the midfield position. I think you need to take the brakes off him a little bit and let him get a little bit more advanced, which you've seen a little bit of late.
Let's just finish off the papers for you. So the front of the Telegraph this morning is that picture of Eden Hazard and then Sterling, I wouldn't walk off in protest. Hazard lights up the bridge, same picture on the back of the Guardian this morning. And also, stay and fight, Sterling tells players to call out racism but not walk off the pitch. And the Irish Times this morning, they're leading with Guardiola says City are out to win quintuple, not quadruple. What's he got?
Oh, that's City. Weak. It's the Community Shield thing again. We've gone City back to the old Jose Mourinho.
Community Shield within English football. I think he's just winding people up. I think he's sitting there trolling, going, how can, what's the
I
most...
I wish you hadn't have gone there, because that, I got fed up with Mourinho holding the fingers up and claiming the Community Shield in terms of, you know, my prize. You've got to respect the fact that I've won the Community Shield. And I don't know how he's woven that into the conversation, Guardiola. I wish he'd stayed away from it. I mean, he's got enough kudos already, enough respect in terms of what he's achieved. I don't think he needs to go clutching and claiming the Community Shield as well.
In Spain, in Germany, where I have been, the Super Cup is an important trophy. Always. We've had the feeling we've won two titles and have three to play, but the people say just one title, one title.
But that's the point. We're not in Spain and Germany. It's England, isn't it? It's viewed differently. That's a fact.
Yeah,
so don't claim it. Don't go around claiming that. No, it's you're wrong. I'm right.
I mean, the European Super Cup, I understand. That's like, you know, there's a bit of glamour attached.
Exactly,
that empty stadium in Monaco.
It's Shazam.
And then, so Emmett Malone's piece is, latest FAI statement leaves room for more possibilities. And those possibilities are fairly endless. If there is a fracture in the board of the FAI at the moment, who knows what's going to happen before the Oireachtas Committee tomorrow morning. Meeting kicks off at 9 o'clock. So accountancy firm Grant Thornton have been at FAI headquarters in Aberystwyth for the last week to review books, records and ledgers the FAI have revealed. In a statement, President Donal Conway said the organisation had informed Sport Ireland it is moving as fast as we can to formulate an accurate reply to inquiries relating to the €100,000 loan reportedly made by John Delaney to the association in April 2017 and then apparently repaid 2 months later. So,
people still use ledgers? A ledger's still a common thing in the office these days? Go and find me that ledger. on the top shelf.
Requesting Kenny. I mean, I'd say they're virtual legends.
Your eyes is it's not an actual.
I doubt it. I mean,
the dust. Maybe sling it out. The dust settles on the top of the desk. Not that type of ledger there.
The Pickwick Papers from Dixon from Charles Dickens. Any other back page headlines from the?
No, I would like to mention Raheem Sterling. To be honest, you mentioned there already in terms of some of his cards. I think Sterling's very interesting. To listen to, particularly his views on the issue of racism. He's come out very strong in terms of how he perceives how players should react to, and he's very strong in terms of no player should be walking off the pitch. The right message to send is to stay on the pitch and to get your message across by in terms of keeping your concentration, keeping your level up, and if you're a forward attacking player as Sterling is, putting the ball into net and keep playing at that high level and send that message out to the people. You can shout what you want at me, it's not going to affect me, I'm too mentally strong, I'm going to shove this back down your throat. It takes him back a little bit to, like, Cyril Regis, bless him, died not too long ago. There's a lot of people talking about Cyril Regis and the time he played and the black players at West Bromwich Albion at the time and the amount of racist taunts which they had to receive, which was quite unbelievable, and how and some quotes attributed to Regis in terms of what he thought of and how felt the best way he felt he could approach. And it was very similar to this what Sterling was talking about. He came out and he said, look, I didn't want to show these people how it had affected me. I wanted to concentrate on my game. I desperately wanted to put that ball into the back of the net. That was my answer to these people. And I have a lot of respect for that, because that's the hardest thing. I've never been in that situation, but it must be the hardest thing to do, is to keep yourself on the pitch, continually hear that those kind of insults, those racist insults coming from the stand, but somehow to be able to block them out, park it to the side, keep your concentration, and almost plough through it and maintain those high levels in terms of performance. For me, I have a huge amount of to go down that particular type of avenue. For me, I hugely admire those type of players, and Sterling in particular is coming out with that kind of theme. Other players have taken a different approach. Danny Rode is very vocal this week, talking about he might take a different approach, he'd walk off the football, he's getting fed up with football, that type of thing. And a lot of people coming out saying, oh, I have a huge admiration for Danny Rose. Well, look, I've a huge amount of understanding for Danny Rose in terms of, but I certainly wouldn't say I'd admire somebody greatly for walking off the pitch. If they heard a racist slur, I'm off the pitch, lads, you're all coming off with me.
That's
an easy thing to do, Jed. That doesn't take
you. It's not easy. It's not easy to walk off the pitch. I actually think that I think part of the problem here is that we're only asking the young black players in England to take leadership on this. Where are their teammates and colleagues? Where's Kevin De Bruyne coming out and saying, this is absolute bullshit and I'm walking off and I'm standing out in solidarity? Where's the PFA when they're dealing with this? Where's the managers? Like, why is it up to
I think the PFA and the associations have been reasonably vocal on this particularly. You can make the argument, I think, Jerry, maybe 20, 30 years ago. Not now. I think there's a huge platform now for individual clubs. Clubs now doing a huge amount of work, not just the last couple of years, for a long time now in terms of the community work, educational work, getting the message out there. Clubs themselves now are putting it out, very vocal now, public coming out there in terms of they will not tolerate any kind of racist behaviour, taunts, etc., sexist. You could broaden that out. So I think clubs have been very vocal on that. I don't buy this argument National Associate clubs aren't doing enough, and this argument for me for kind of banning international teams, even this, I think we're totally going down the wrong route there. You're talking about players walking off with players showing solidarity. Again, I'd look at it the opposite way. I think it's the last thing for me. It's a slippery slope, actually. Players walking off the pitch, it's got to be absolute mayhem, and I'm not exactly sure what it solves. Walking off, what does that resolve like? What message does that send to people in the stands?
If you walk off, obviously, then all of a sudden, it's something that is dealt with at a structural level. It's like the tennis ball protest.
How is it dealt with then?
Well, because if a team walks off, a game gets forfeited, and so suddenly there's a conversation about what is an appropriate response.
Where is that leading us? What role is that leading us down players walk off? What are the mechanisms then that suddenly kick in?
How did hooliganism get stamped out of, in-stadium hooliganism, how did they stamp that out? What stopped that?
Well, I think education played a part in that. The work clubs are doing behind the scenes with their supporters in the community, sending out the right messages. Young people, supporters coming into the fold.
Is it not banning English clubs from Europe? Was that not like one of the main things that happened here? Is you're not allowed to play in this competition anymore because your fans can't be trusted to.
No, I don't think so. No, I disagree with you. I don't see that as a big. I don't see that as a big factor at all in terms of hooliganism.
In the
I wouldn't say no influence. I didn't think it was a big influence, and I don't.
It absolutely was. English football suddenly had to take the hooliganism problem seriously. Before that, it was like it's just a problem between these fans over here, and it doesn't matter. Then they get kicked out of Europe, and they're missing out on for a decade. It took them to effectively recover their position.
So you're making the point the effect that had it on clubs. Now clubs taking a more active role, more proactive role. And this is what I'm talking about. Seriously. We're at this stage now where clubs are and have for a long time,
but they're not. They're not if the fans are still in, if they're fans.
It's not, but this is a social. You can't. It's too easy to point the finger at the football club.
It is a social issue, and so all of society needs to use all of the architecture available to it to step forward and go, this is completely unacceptable. Clearly, the fans aren't policing themselves to the point where some people think it's acceptable to come to a stadium in the Premier League when they know they're going to be on camera. Like that's the thing. They know they're going to get caught. Yeah. I don't know.
So if you catch them on camera, you're not necessarily public and shame them. You know who they are, and you ban them from life. That's as much, for me as a football club, that's as much as you can do. As long as you're taking the responsibility seriously behind the scenes, you're very proactive in the community amongst your supporters, getting the message out there, this is not tolerated, we're not this type of football club, and doing this, that's as much as you can do as a football club. If you're doing as much as you can, and some idiot walks into your stadium a weekend and makes a racist comment, for me, it's all wrong that the club should be
punished.
Punished. Any shape or form. It's totally wrong. If you're not taking it seriously as a football club, you're not getting though. You're sending mixed messages out. You're not taking the thing seriously whatsoever. In terms of the security inside the stadium is another thing as well. You're not taking your responsibility. Well, then there's an argument. Well, you're not doing enough, so there's going to be consequences. But when you're actively doing as much as you can as a football club, for me, you should not be coming back and pointing the finger at the football club and saying, this is your responsibility. You're going to be punished. Point deduction. We're going to kick you out of competition, whatever it is,
if you're doing,
that makes no sense whatsoever to me.
Okay, fair enough. If all the clubs are doing everything they can, I'm not sure that all the clubs are doing all they can. We're asking individual players to be the thought leaders for an entire country in Raheem Sterling's case, and we're putting all the responsibility for what's happening on his shoulders as opposed to saying everybody needs to step forward collectively. And I would like to see his teammates who aren't.
Well, I think they should. And they can do that publicly. Social media now as well, Jared. Yeah. There's no excuse for you getting that message out there and supporting your teammates.
You said you never experienced anything like this. Not so. One of my abiding memories of being in college is the IRA bombing in Canary Wharf in 96, which was kind of, at the time it looked like it was the end of the peace process because there'd been the ceasefire and then this broke the ceasefire. Was there any talk? You were living in London at that stage in 96, maybe in Birmingham. Did it ever come up at that point?
No. There might have been a nod. I don't. There might be over the years, like a couple of things. Yours is this, yours is that. Water off a duck's back to me, like. I mean, that would probably be constituted as a racist comment. I don't know. In modern days now, will somebody calling you an Irish this and that probably leaning towards racist, would it?
It was sectarian anyway.
Well, sectarian anyway, yeah. So. No, at the time I wouldn't have. That would have been kind of wore off a duck's back to me. That was just kind of part of the game, something which I had to do. But if that was the mentality generally, whether you are Welsh, you would have got that Welsh, Scottish, you would have got you, Scottish, you, bum, this, that was it. Like that was part and parcel. And now that's slightly different. I understand what we're talking about. But it was just a case of you get on with it. You know what I mean? You just get on with it. You walk past it like, and you don't let it affect you. That was just something which, but I didn't have a huge amount of it.
No,
that was very occasional.
Opposition fans or opposition players or?
No, very rarely. But I don't think it would have got under my skin, Jared, to be honest with you. You know what I mean? It's just, I don't know, maybe it was a different time. We're living in different times now. Of course, any type of insults like that, obviously, have to be shown for what they are. You can't get away with that. But it was different. People dealt with those things a little bit differently. Maybe people a little bit more sensitive to those type of things. Now, I'm not too sure. Yeah, obviously, it's not as simple as that. But there certainly was a different approach. Those type of things were still unacceptable then as they are now. But certainly it was a different type of mentality then, certainly amongst players. I've mentioned Cyril Regis there, how he dealt with those. That, I find that absolutely fascinating. But I think it is interesting. I am interested in listening to players. Sterling, particularly for me, is a very interesting character, like I said. And the approach that he's taken to this, we saw it in Montenegro, his game against England, clear... racist chanting over there, and I just loved the way he dealt with it. I just, if I was a teammate of his,
if I was a supporter, looking at him,
looking at his body language, how his chest out, shoulders back, I can hear it. Yeah, they're 10 feet behind me, but yes, they give me the ball. I'm still going to play. I'm still going to affect this game. I'm still going to be the best player in the pitch. And when I put the ball in the back of the net, which he did, cup a bit of that. That for me, as a teammate, that's exactly, for me, I'm looking at him thinking, I'm going to battle for this fella, as opposed to, hold on, lads, come on, I'm off. Are you coming with me? I can understand it.
Yeah, I can
what
too.
I'm saying in terms of, as a teammate, what would really form me, what I'd like to see, what would really engage me, and I think, oh, this is I'm absolutely in awe of this person. It'd be the opposite approach in terms of, I'm going to stand me ground. Yeah, I'm going to, whatever you're going to throw at me, I'm going to take it, and I'm going to come out on the other side. And I think over time, yeah, I think that wins people over. It won't win certain people over who got those entrenched views and never going to change. But people on the sides who maybe look at it, maybe don't intervene, let these people get away with it, and see that type of reaction from Sterling and his like on the pitch, I think over time it changes their perceptions. Maybe they will get a bit more involved. You're talking about fans not policing themselves. I think over time that'll encourage them to start policing themselves, because they look at the player and think, you know what? I mean, the way he's behaving.
It's pretty grim that people need encouragement to stamp out racism.
Yeah, but it's natural. Yeah, but that's not an easy, in that kind of environment, football stadium. Yeah, that's not easy to step forward. People.
Those people are cowards, not standing up for the things that you believe in and the things that keep society together. Because otherwise...
Ah, that's too harsh. No, yeah, that's not too harsh. If you've been in a football stadium, you're stuck beside 10, 15 young boys...
Who are racially abusing somebody?
Yeah, aggressive.
Yeah, but if they're racially abusing somebody, you've got it. You've got your
10-year-old son along.
Okay, well,
that's not easy. It's an easy thing. And I'd like to think I'd intervene.
Of people collectively, and we're talking about, like... the fans of a Premier League team, effectively here, there are hundreds of people who don't have their kids with them who can turn around and go, shut up, this is our team, and you are representing us in a horrible, disgusting way. So asking the players to be the ones leading that is putting all the responsibility on them when the responsibility is on us.
It's a collective. No, you're right. It's a collective thing, and that would be the ideal scenario. Fans become actively inside the stadium. You're absolutely right. And I think it is changing, Ger. It has been changing over the last 20. I know it's prevalent at the moment. There's a lot of individual stuff being spoken about, games at the weekend and stuff. But generally, Ger, I think the game has moved on and it has improved for the good. We're not exactly where we want to be. We never will be, though. Yeah, well, this is a problem in society, generally speaking. It's always going to fall inside the stadiums at some point.
Yeah.
And we're going to experience it.
I think you can police stadiums, though, because, you know, people have paid a ticket to be there, and it's a privilege, it's not a right to go and congregate and support teams. We've got to move on, because we've loads of good stuff coming your way. And we'll talk about some other stuff about the football in a little while with John Duggan. We'll preview the Spurs game tonight. Hashtag OTBAM for your comments. Nigel Owens has been talking to us about the best way to deal with abusive fans, and he had got some pretty interesting things to say. So not a million miles away from the topic we've just been talking about. Adrian Barry got a chance to talk to him at the IRFU's launch of the Union Cup, Europe's largest LGBT inclusive rugby tournament, which takes place in Dublin in June. You can check out unioncupdublin.ie for more on the tournament, which is proudly supported by Vodafone. Have a look.
All right, we're here at the launch of the Union Cup Dublin 2019. It takes place at DCU June 7th to 9th. And I'm delighted to say at the launch is Nigel Owens, as you can see. Good afternoon to you, Nigel.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm excellent. Will you talk to us a little bit about the importance of the Union Cup, what it means to Dublin and the wider LGBT community?
Well, I think it's hugely important, I think, because what the Union Cup and teams like the Emerald Warriors do is they allow an environment where people in the LGBT community can participate and play in rugby and feel safe and feel comfortable within that environment, because still in society and still in all sports, there is an element of a minority where it won't make people feel safe, people from the LGBT community. Now, a lot of people in the LGBT community feel that they can't play in their local rugby clubs or in their local community. And that's not because those local community clubs are not inclusive or not welcoming, because most of them are. There are various different reasons. The individuals may feel not comfortable in that environment for whatever reason. Maybe they don't feel their ability is good enough in that environment. Maybe they feel they only want to play rugby because they're playing with their group of friends. Like a lot of people play rugby because of their group of friends. So there are many, many different reasons. And so what the teams like the Emerald Warriors and the Union Cup as a competition then allows a competition for LGBT clubs like the Emerald Warriors and many, many others across Europe to come together in a tournament which all the other local community clubs will have within their own leagues and within their own tournaments, for example. So it is hugely important, I think, because rugby is an inclusive sport. There is no doubt about that. I wouldn't be able to referee today if it wasn't an inclusive sport. So nobody can say that rugby is not inclusive. Rugby is, but there are still barriers. There are still a minority of people within rugby and within all sports that don't like people for whatever reason, whether it's their sexuality, the colour of the skin, their religious beliefs are from different countries. So, you know, this is a huge step, I think, in progressiveness and in breaking down those barriers that people are able to participate in rugby and be able to feel themselves. I think it's hugely important as well that it doesn't become isolated, that, you know, that the LGBT community are the only ones who can play rugby in the LGBT community, and in our local community and clubs are not welcoming. If you're LGBT, you can't play in those clubs. We can't have that difference between them. We want people to play in whatever club they want to, but until people feel comfortable in doing that, then it's hugely important, the Union Cup and the great work and the clubs like the Emerald Warriors are doing.
Yeah, it's a good point. Just something that I was interested in to hear you speak a little bit more about, maybe, was the point about general abuse. And I know that one report that I read, it was from the UK, was saying that a huge percentage, over 80%, I think, of gay men and women are still the subject of homophobic insults over the course of playing in sport. We've obviously seen, you mentioned the colour of skin, we've seen Danny Rose's comments recently about, I can't wait to see the back of football. And there's been various theories put out there about how we tackle that, whether it's, do we have a points deduction? Do we ban a team from a tournament? What's your opinion about how to take that on?
I think it's very difficult to ban a team from a tournament and to take away the points deduction, for example, because the majority of those clubs and the supporters of the clubs, the players within the clubs, will be hugely good, decent people who will respect people who are different to what they are. And it's, we have to remember now, it's a minority of people out there. So the minority of people who shout racial abuse, homophobic abuse from the stadiums, at whatever that may be, at players or at officials or at anybody involved in the game, are just generally bad people who don't like people for whatever reason. And if their team gets deducted points, those type of people don't really care. So the people who are punished are the rest of the good people within that club who may
so
be doing
do?
Great
the,
work.
I think
the answer is in identifying those people and getting them out to the stadiums and banning them from the stadiums. And the people who can really make a difference are the people who are in the stadiums themselves. The people don't stand by and say nothing. If somebody's in the stadium and they see somebody shouting racial abuse or homophobic abuse, that they turn around and tell those people, you know, hey, that's enough, that's not acceptable here. Hopefully that'll be enough to stop it. If it doesn't, then you bring it to the attention of the club or the stewards so they can get those people out to the stadiums and to deal with it. So to me, that is the answer, I think, because I think, you know, imagine banning a club or abandoning a game where the 99% of the spectators in there are good, decent people. It's them you're punishing. You're not actually punishing that individual or that small group of minority, because they're the type of people who won't really care. They may even think that they've achieved something by getting the game banned because they've shouted abuse at a black player or a gay player on the field. So I think that is the best way to deal with it, I think. And as long as those clubs are doing all they can in identifying those individuals and getting them out to the stadiums and out of that environment, then, you know, those clubs should be supported in what they're trying to do and trying to achieve. And it's those people in there, really. I've always, you know, said that, you know, not only do we have a responsibility in what we say and what we do, you know, we sometimes have more responsibility when we stand by and say and do nothing. And that goes to the people, you know, don't stand by and say nothing when you hear unacceptable abuse being shouted. If you are the majority, and turn around to the person and say, hey, that's enough, you know. Mm. You're not welcome here if that's your attitude. That's what really makes a difference. Yeah. And those are the people that can really make the difference, I believe.
And it's not just a sport thing. Obviously, it's something that...
It's in society, in everyday life as well.
You're such an eloquent and passionate advocate and ambassador for LGBT rights, obviously. I did wonder if it was ever something that you thought, Jesus, I'm tired, or I'm, you know, your passion for it diminishes at any point, or is it, how does that weigh on you?
No, it doesn't at all, really, to be honest with you, because I know what it's like to be in those dark times. I know what it's like to come within 20, 30 minutes of losing my own life because I was in a very, very dark place and couldn't feel I could live my life anymore because I was gay. I didn't want to be gay, and the environment around me was not giving the impression that it would be welcoming for me as a gay person. So I know what it's like. And I think when we make the environment a better and safer place, that people are able to be themselves and don't have to fear about living their normal lives as a gay person or as a black person and not feeling, you know, that you are going to be the subject of racism and treated differently or homophobic abuse. So I do think that, you know, the more people who speak up about their own experiences, the more people who speak up and show that, look, it doesn't matter who you are. You know, as long as you're a decent person, then you should be treated the same as everybody else. So, and, you know, if by me speaking out about it, and if I need to speak about it every day and it's making a difference, then I'll do so. I hope there'll come a time where I won't have to speak about it anymore, because it's not an issue in sport, and it's not an issue in society in everyday life. And I think we're a long way from there, but we certainly are in a much better place now than we've been in the last 10, 20, 30 years or so. But, you know, we are still seeing a minority of people out there who are just bad people. But hopefully, as time goes by, those people will get less and less, hopefully. And I don't think we can underestimate as well the influence that each individual has on helping that progressiveness in society, and also in educating young people as well. Education plays a huge, huge part in just educating children to accept people who are different to them but are just like them. You know, and I think that's hugely important. So educating people is hugely important as well in making a difference.
Yeah, well, for today, it's a pleasure to listen to you speak on the topic, so long may that continue.
Yeah, so Nigel Owens agreeing a bit there with Kenny and a bit with me.
Cheers, Nigel.
Who looks younger?
He's 47 years of age, I reckon. Yeah, no, I'm 47. I threw the question to you. I did
Google how old he was.
Genuinely, you think he looks younger than me? Is it the glasses? Will I take the glasses off? Right, go again.
Oh, well, that's completely different.
Kenny, you're not Clark Kent.
You know I'm not overly sensitive. I'm not hypersensitive to stuff like this. But you genuinely think he looks younger, yeah? Wow. That's a big reality check.
Tom, good morning to you. How you doing?
Oh, yeah, not bad.
Tom, yeah, we're going to get some
fillings.
Just, you know, it doesn't matter. Like, we're all going to age.
I agree with you. I totally agree with you.
You're not an American TV.
Aging disgracefully is my, yeah, yeah.
You're going to look exactly the same now for the next 30 years. And when you're 60, everyone will go, oh, geez, Kenny, you could pass for 47.
I'm happy in my own skin. 47 is a good age for me. Yeah, I think. Yeah, more miserable by the day, so they tell me.
Let's start with Chelsea, who warmed up and stormed into third, rather, in the Premier League last night. They got the better of West Ham on Monday Night Football. Eden Hazard got both goals in the 2-0 win. The first goal of the season contender probably did his transfer chances no harm, can you reckon?
Another 20 million on top. Yeah. I agree with that.
Tottenham's new stadium gets its first taste of Champions League football tonight. Mauricio Pochettino's side host quadruple chases Manchester City in the first leg of the Champions League quarterfinal. Aguero could feature, having missed the last couple of games with a muscle injury. But Pep Guardiola does not want his side to be influenced by the surroundings.
It affects if we think about the spectators, if we think about what we have to do on the pitch. It doesn't affect. And of course, in the Champions League, all the games away, the supporters support the team more than ever. So we know exactly what you're going to face.
Meanwhile, Liverpool continue their quest for a domestic and European double when they host Porto at Anfield. Jurgen Klopp is hoping his side have developed since getting past Bayern in the last round.
For the game tomorrow night, only that we are now a bit more experienced, and you saw that in the second game against Bayern. And I think, how was that after the game? Everybody spoke about when we drew here, after 0-0, it was like, that's not enough. And we didn't even think it. It's not that we said something and thought something different. I said, oh, game on still and everything, and thought, oh my God, how can we do that? And the boys were exactly the same. It was clear we have a chance at Munich, and we used that chance. And now we have to face Porto with exactly the same respect.
Both of those games getting underway at 8 o'clock this evening. There's half a dozen games in the Championship as well. Leeds a chance to go into the automatic promotion spots if they get the better of Preston at Deepdale. And there's a meeting of two other sides in the playoff places as well, as Bristol City host West Brom. Republic of Ireland's women's side in action later on this evening as well there in Italy. Rhianna Jarrett's back for Colin Bell's side there in Reggio Emiliano. That kick-off there at 5:30. In rugby, Munster head coach Johan van Graan says he's now planning on retaining his coaching team after committing his own future to the province. He agreed on his stay, an extension on his stay at Thomond Park until the summer of 2022, and the contracts of forwards coach Terry Flannery and attack coach Felix Jones are set to expire at the end of the current campaign. But van Graan says he feels the entire backroom team are working well together, and keeping them will be one of the next steps in the process. In Gaelic games, Monaghan have suffered a serious injury blow at the start of their Ulster Football Championship campaign, less than 6 weeks away. It's been confirmed that Darren Hughes suffered a broken ankle while playing for his club Scotstown on Sunday and will miss the provincial championship entirely. Monaghan already hoping that Niall Cairns will be fit for their May 18th meeting with Cavan after the midfielder underwent heart surgery around New Year's. And the family of Sean Cox are sending warm wishes to supporters ahead of Friday night's fundraiser at the Aviva Stadium between the Republic of Ireland 11 and the Liverpool legends. Sean,
you playing, Kenny?
You playing?
I'll be there, Jer.
Be there.
I'll be there.
Well, hang on. Are you togged out?
I could well be.
Is this one of those situations, you know, when you're a kid and you're like, oh, if I bring my boots to the game, I'll get a game?
Yeah, if I just linger around the away dressing room for long enough, I get an invitation in.
Martin O'Neill's in charge, is he? Is he, or who's
I think it's Mick, I believe.
Sorry, it's Mick.
And obviously Kenny Dalglish. Yeah, not a lot of the lads looking forward to it, actually. Yeah, a big occasion, yeah. Obviously for the right reasons.
And hopefully there's a huge crowd as well. It's Sean Cox's 54th birthday today.
Yeah, there's two clips here. One of them kind of describes in detail the kind of reality of Martina Cox and their kids' lives right now. It's pretty horrific.
Life has changed, you know, a lot. You know, it's just myself and the three kids at home in our house, and then Sean's been in hospital for the last year, and that has been incredibly difficult. You know, life revolves around, you know, going to see Sean and, you know, all the different plans and things that have to be in place.
Yeah, such a rough time for them and the family it must have been for the last year. But she says they have been overwhelmed with all the support they've received since.
I'd just like to thank everybody for the huge support they've given to Sean over the last year, and just to say a massive thank you to everybody.
I just think that clip brings home the kind of reality. We were going to talk about this incident so much, but when you just hear their day-to-day difficulties.
Yeah.
It's so rough, isn't it?
Yeah. So that was kind of personal stories. Really does. It is life-changing. And we focus, obviously, on Sean, obviously so, but it's that ripple effect in terms of his wife, the family, his kids in particular. Must be kind of traumatic, like, you know what I mean, seeing their dad having to go through that. So, yeah, and what I like is obviously it's not much in terms of what's happening in Dublin, but how the kind of football family rallies around. We've been talking some maybe negative terms, Jared, in terms of the kind of the racism which is prevalent in the modern game, but maybe we don't talk too enough about a lot of the good things which are happening around the game, and how in situations like this that kind of football and family really does kind of rally around. We kind of look after our own. So by all accounts, it's been a great response from everybody when first this was kind of intimated this was going to happen. So, yeah, hopefully there will be a good turnout, and I'm sure it will be. And the practical implications of the night in terms of financially, maybe to support the family. But even bigger than that, I think for Martina and the kids, just knowing, you know, that people are behind them, people are aware of their story, the sympathy for them, and obviously the people want to help as much as they can. I think that means a lot.
Yeah, and if anybody wants to help and can't go to the game, you can just get on Ticketmaster and buy a ticket, because that's the most important thing. Obviously, showing up on the night will be great emotional support too, but like, the money is hugely important. The cost of permanent care for somebody who's suffered a brain injury is massive. So you can, if you can't go to the game, you can still help out by getting a ticket on ticketmaster.ie. Now, Tom, thanks for that.
Thanks, guys.
Here's a bit more from Nigel Owens. We did get a chance to talk to him about the challenge of refereeing rugby matches. He was at the RFU's launch of the Union Cup, Europe's largest LGBT-inclusive rugby tournament, which takes place in Dublin in June. Check out unioncupdublin.ie for more on the tournament, which is proudly supported by Vodafone.
Rugby World Cup year, obviously, and we've been speaking to a lot of players about the nerves that kind of kick in at this time of the year and interested in all the various topics in that regard as well. One interesting piece that jumped out that I wanted to ask you about, and I know you've read it, Matt Williams in the Irish Times on Friday, was talking about the offside laws in rugby, and as he sees it, they're not being refereed at the minute, that actually the referee has too much going on at line-out, breakdown, tackle area. There's too much going on. Shouldn't have to have eyes in the back of their head, essentially, to referee as he sees it infringes in those instances. What's your take on it?
Well, if the player stayed on site, we wouldn't have to worry about it, wouldn't we? look, every game is different. And the laws are there for a specific reason, in to allow a game of rugby. And it's up to us as referees to make sure we apply those laws. And as long as we referee the laws and ensure that the players are behind the hindmost foot and that there is space for teams to play, then the game will benefit to that. And I think on the whole, we do that. Now, there are some games, there will be games where a referee, could even be myself, there are games where a referee wasn't that hot on the offside that day, and there were a couple of offsides in the game that weren't picked up, and that may then contribute to a lack of space in the game. But I don't think that is a huge concern week in, week out. And if it is something that's a concern in that game, then the referee will pick that up in his review. His performance reviewer will pick it up in his review, and his referee's manager will pick it up in that review. And it's something then that he will be aware of and he'll address in the next game. So, you know, we need to work hard and make sure that we continue to work hard in making sure that we get space. And that involves your assistant referees in helping you as a referee as well. So I am not sort of overly concerned about it, but yes, there is a fair point that, you know, we need to make sure that if there is a trend of the offside line being illegally defended, then we as referees need to make sure that we work hard on that and that we deal with the issues. Like, we 3 or 4 years ago, the contact in the air was a huge issue in the game. What we did as referees, we dealt with it, you know, under the guidance of Alan Roland, who's the World Rugby Referee Manager at now. Look, we need, and Joel Jute before him, and the various referees, managers of different competitions, we need to get this out of the game. And by refereeing it hard but fair, we don't see much contact in the air anymore. We had the same with the neck rolls and the spear tacklers. You know, we refereed them hard when they became an issue. You don't see them in the game. So if the offside line becomes an issue, you know, rest assured that as referees, under the guidance of people like Alan Roland, we will be told, look, we need to be firmer with this, and we will be firmer with it, and then it will not become an issue in the game if it is.
And I suppose his thing was that he had watched, it was the Heineken Cup last weekend in Super Rugby, and he was saying that every game I watched, players are cheating, they're at it everywhere, it can't be regulated. It seemed like it was the Wild West, I think might have been an expression that he used at one point, but your sense is, it's not quite that, there might be an issue and we'll deal with it. Is that your sense?
Well, I refereed in Saracen Glasgow in that quarterfinal the weekend, and I've reviewed the game and my performance reviewer has reviewed the game as well, and I think I gave 2 or 3 penalties for offside in the game, and I didn't pick a clear and obvious one up that should have been penalised.
Right.
So as far as I'm aware in that game, it was not an issue. I've seen other games where it's not been issues. I have seen games where the offside line could have been refereed better. I've refereed games myself when I've reviewed the game and thought, I should have been a bit better on the offside lines. A couple of offsides here I've missed. So, you know, it's just a referee then focusing on that, I think. And look, you're always working hard to improve as a referee. There's always boundaries in the game which the players will push, and it's up to you as a referee to address it.
On that one, do you think is the game getting you were obviously your very famous statement about soccer and that sort of thing, which in some regards I'm sure at some point you were like, geez, I wish I hadn't said that, but sometimes it seems to me, and actually we've had a high profile Irish player in studio recently who was talking about the treatment that he gets from the opposition, and sometimes he'll think about exaggerating it. You're smiling because I think you know who I'm talking about. He'll maybe exaggerate the contact so that you know what's happening, or sometimes he'll retaliate. But ultimately, his overall point was, I'm not sure what to do to make sure that the referee knows this is happening. So forgetting about that instance, do you see those trends in the game generally, that there is more of that, like, diving culture is maybe overstating?
I don't think it's an area of a huge concern at the moment in the game, but there is no doubt there are occasions when it does happen. It's happened over the couple of seasons where players have taken a dive, or a player comes up and waving and asking for a yellow card to be given to a player, and we don't want that in the game. You know, what the players need to do is just to trust the referee, that the referee will deal with it. And if the referee's not picking something up that's going on in the game, then it's up to the captain, when the time is right, to speak to the referee and say, and I always tell the captain, look, if there's an area of concern in the game which you think that I am not picking up for whatever reason, or my team isn't, then talk to me about it. And the captain will tell me, look, for example, look, Nigel, we think that the offside line seems to be, you know, creeping with them quite a bit. And I say, OK, I'll have a look. And I may have a look and think, no, they're fine, they're
offside.
Does
that happen often?
It doesn't happen often, but captains do come up to me, you know, and then you'll have a look, and that's a fair point, and then you speak to the opposition team, look, and then you deal with it like that. So there is a way for the players to convey that message to the referee without bringing in the theatrics to the game, and you know, you just have to trust the referee to do his job and do that. Now, if a referee doesn't do that, then it will be highlighted in his performance review that he should have been better on this certain area of the game. And it is something then that he will address going forward. If he doesn't address it, then, you know, it will affect his performance and quite frankly so, his appointments as well. So, you know, there is, you know, a way. So, look, we don't want to see the diving about. We don't want to see players running up and surrounding referees and questioning decisions all the time. There is a proper channel of communication in a respectful way that can be done on the field to deal with any issues that arise. And you're saying that we have seen isolated instances of creeping into the game, and it's up to us as referees to make sure that it becomes something that happens on the odd occasion rather than something becomes the norm.
Just finally, we mentioned the Rugby World Cup. Obviously, Wales' dominance in the Six Nations is a bit of a nightmare for us here, and might be a bit of a nightmare for you as well. It might hinder your opportunities, obviously, come Rugby World Cup, but they're flying it, obviously.
Oh, they are. No, listen, I will be a very, very, very happy Welshman if I am sitting in the stadium watching Wales lift the Webb Ellis Trophy. There's no doubt about that, because to me, your country becomes before anything else that you as an individual want to achieve. And look, yeah, you know, Wales are on a 14-game unbeaten run. They'll be going into the World Cup quietly, confident in
not
in
so quiet
habit.
Generally, Norm Wales.
I don't know. We're quite a shy really? Nation when it comes here. We don't like to boast much, so we keep things nice and quiet. I think it's a Celtic thing, maybe. And look, you know, they're in a good place at the moment, you know, but they'll have to continue that habit of winning and play well to beat some really good teams in the World Cup. I think this year's World Cup is probably one of the most open ever, I think, where you're looking at probably 5, 6, 7 teams, maybe even 8, who are quite capable of beating anybody on that day, which means they're quite capable of going on to win that World Cup. And that's lovely, and I'm sure everybody's getting excited about it. I know we're very excited about it in Wales, that's for sure.
Yeah. Why not? Nigel, thanks a million.
Yeah, because they're going to win it. That's why they're excited in Wales. Great stuff as ever there from Nigel Owens. We'll stick that full 15 minutes together and stick it up on our YouTube channel if you missed any of it. He was at the IRFU's launch of the Union Cup, which is Europe's largest LGBT-inclusive rugby tournament. Check out unioncupdublin.ie for more on the competition, which is proudly supported by Vodafone. Referees and communication, frequently football commentators and analysts look at rugby and go, geez, it's nice the way the referee explains everything and it's mic'd up and the whole stadium can hear it. Do you like that?
Not overly so. No, I think it is very interesting, Nigel Owens in particular enjoy listening to, and that aspect of the game of rugby, yeah, just in terms of the relationship between referees and players, generally speaking, tends to be a good one. A bit of respect between them both, treat each other with respect and how they generally speak to each other, generally accept the referee's decisions, although I think that's, watching rugby the last maybe year or two, maybe that's just on the turn, slightly. So, yeah, I'm not a big one in terms of, oh, I want to hear everything. That put a huge amount of pressure on referees, knowing that everything they say is now is going to be everybody in the stadium, everybody on TV is going to listen to what you're saying. I think the relationship is important, how they treat each other. Communication should be encouraged, unless you're Ashley Young, because I'm absolutely fed up with him communicating with referees. It's just a game doesn't go by. A free kick can't be given against Manchester United, where Ashley Young, no matter where he is on the pitch, within 2 seconds getting himself into the referee's face and giving his opinion what he thinks.
It's leadership, right?
The referee, oh, this is it. Once you've got the arm, it must be an obligation to get into the referee's face and give an opinion what you think. That's just a personal thing for me with Ashley Young, don't get me wrong. But yeah, but no, I wouldn't be necessarily be a big fan of the get mic'd up. But a bit of communication, I think, is no bad thing.
It would stop the constant swearing at the referees really quickly if it started to get mic'd up, because the players would be publicly shamed.
I don't really think so. But that's a natural thing. That's not a conscious thing. I'm going to go up to the referee, I'm going to swear, I'm going to make sure he knows if I swear it. And that's a natural thing. It's kind of an instinctive, for Jesus, say blah, 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 whatever. I don't necessarily think that's going to stop. In that particular instance, you're not aware that referee's mic'd up, you're not doing all the permutations.
Diego Costa called the referee at the weekend mother of a whore, or I shit on
him. Yeah, and he's been dealt with. I don't think we necessarily needed to hear that, did we?
He's going to do it again.
So you're coming from the entertainment industry. Yeah, this is what's driving you, purely selfish motives. Yeah? I don't necessarily want to be hearing that.
No, you don't need to hear it, because they'll stop saying it, I think. I wonder how you change behaviour. Let's move on, because we do have to talk, we haven't talked yet about the feeling in the pit of Kenny Cunningham's stomach, is that Spurs are going to beat Man City over two legs. They're going to go through.
Yeah, I'll have to see that.
Spider
as
sense.
Always, yeah, it's not just spider sense, because I mean, I think there is an argument there for, you can make an obvious argument, football and reasons, why Tottenham
give me the obvious
can
argument.
Get the better. Well, just in terms of the quality that they can put on the football pitch, Spurs have struggled a little bit, key players missing through injury during the course of the season. I might be proved wrong, but I don't think any of those key players will be missing, certainly this evening. Ali in particular, Winks have been an interesting one. I don't know if he's fit and available. But everybody looks as if Kane's back in the team. He's got a few games under his belt. He's kind of struggled a bit injury-wise, getting his match fitness back. But I just think as well, and I'm not one who overplays the significance, the home support, the atmosphere in there, opposition players are going to wilt. I've never bought into that argument. But I think in terms of how the home support at the new, is it the new White Hart Lane? Technically,
whatever
we call it is.
Spurs Stadium?
Is that it? Have we agreed on a new, what is the name of this? Sports Stadium.
Is it White Hart Lane?
It's White Hart. It's a new White Hart Lane. Are we even saying the new White Hart Lane? Or is it just White Hart Lane?
John, good morning to you.
Morning, Jerry.
All right, John.
Kenny, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm trying to bring you to the conversation, but I'm going to wrestle it back off you now. I'm going to start talking again. Yeah, so I just think how that, I just sense as if that is really going to energise the Spurs players this evening. Not to the point where it's hurt them and scared them stuff. They'll need to be cool, eyes cool on their heads in terms of tactically how they're going to go at the game. But I really feel as if it can lift the Spurs players this evening, and I think I could have a small bearing on the tie. I'm factoring as well.
Now, did you just go against your own firmly held views that the stadium doesn't matter except in this
to the home team?
Because you've got
the home team.
Cents.
No, the home team.
What, for
this
what
evening.
Reason is that?
The home team, as opposed to the away team. I've made the argument it can have a negative effect on the away team. I've never quite bought that, but I think it can really lift the Spurs team this evening. And the individual quality which they have, I still think they have the team which can disrupt Manchester City and get the better of them over the two legs.
I think
there's a lot closer this tie. I see this as a kind of a 55-45.
As a dodgy refereeing decision over the two legs, because like the ghost goal in the Liverpool.
You're not going to lead us on the VAR. Please tell me this isn't going to lead on the dodgy referee. Why we should be using VAR? Thank God for that.
Is your microphone working? 1, 2, 3, give us it.
Hello, this is Tottenham. This is Tottenham Television.
But Tottenham's energy, John, I'm going to cut in it.
We'll let you have the floor, it's okay.
I wasn't officially cutting in, you didn't start talking, but you think the kind of high energy, athletic, the likes of Sissoko in midfield, Son, Kane, Ali, those type of players, that kind of physicality. I know City have it a little bit as well in terms of, City have pace, we know that. But Spurs have a real kind of aggressive, high energy, physicality, box to box. That type of, they can play that type of game as well. And I think that a team that can play that way against Manchester, Liverpool have done it occasionally, have that kind of high intensity, physicality, making tackles, players who can go box to box at pace, and they've disrupted City. I think Spurs can play that type of game as well. And that type of game, I think, can hurt Manchester City over the two legs. John,
are you daring
over to you.
How do I follow that? I don't think we're going to lose tonight. We've got three games against them, I think, in 11 days. I was at the Spurs City game in October 2016, and we bullied them off the park. It was 2-0. It was the first defeat of Pep's reign.
I remember it.
At White Hart Lane, and Ali scored twice. Harry Kane wasn't even playing that day. We struggled against him a bit recently at Wembley. We played two, you know, we were caught out wide. Trippier was poor, I think, for the opening goal that Mahrez scored at Wembley there. But I think we played well against Liverpool despite the result. It's a 52nd competitive game for Manchester City this season. City generally have been doing their damage in the early stages of matches. I think they scored, 26 goals before the 20th minute. So we can keep them quiet. We can get the stadium behind the players. I think that will be a factor.
Thanks, John.
Yeah, we can definitely. I do think psychologically,
there's no inferior already complex amongst these sports.
No, I don't think there is. With Manchester City, we qualify for the Champions League the first time ever by winning at Manchester City. We've gone there and won before at the Etihad. And
the stats coming out of man here, amazing.
I think there are risks. Obviously, if we play a high press, which has worked like for the likes of Liverpool last season with the 3-0 win, and Pep has had a strange record in the Champions League over the last 8 years. You know, with Bayern, he had heavy defeats to Real and Barca. They lost to Monaco, Manchester City. So City can be got at. They can be vulnerable, but they are playing very well. They're going for the quadruple. De Bruyne is a massive danger. I worry a little bit about the midfield, but the Tottenham midfield.
Wings fit tonight?
I think he'll play, yeah, but I'm not sure. So sure how fit he is or how match sharp he is.
Yeah.
I think they probably need to play three at the back. I would say they probably need to play wing-backs and have the likes of Crowd at midfield with Winks and Sissoko. So
I'm not sure about that one. I understand what you're saying in terms of you get that extra man in defence, but the problem that is it leaves you a little bit light down the sides. You play with your wing-backs, but it's very easy then for Manchester City to get those overloads down the side. The Manchester City full-backs to get themselves high early into the Spurs half the pitch. For me, I'd like to see Spurs go 4-3-3 with two natural wide men so you can go and press them as early as Manchester City can high up the pitch. When you play with the wing backs, the Manchester City fullbacks will be able to get the ball under no pressure and get into the Spurs half very easily for me before that kind of pressure comes. I know Spurs have had some success playing there with the back line. They actually do play it very well. For me, it's a back four. Almost out 4-3-3, five across in midfield, and no obvious ins, no obvious avenues for Manchester City. You have to really work to get through your midfield and get at that defensive line. And I think Spurs, you can make an argument for some teams, get that extra defender in there, help you out. But Spurs, in terms of Alderweireld, Vertonghen, you could argue with Sanchez, two of those three for me should be good enough. You pick your fullbacks alongside them to be able to deal with the City front line, as long as they're getting the right type of protection in front. And a midfield five for me gives that back four the type of protection they need.
So Eriksen and Son are essentially playing midfield forwards in that five.
They're so versatile. You could play Eriksen off the line. You could play Son. Ali can play in a wide area as well. You could play Eriksen just off the front in a three, in front of two kind of holding midfielders.
So 4-2-3-1.
We're splitting hairs,
I would want Ali to be picking up Fernandinho. I think we can curb Fernandinho. That'll be important because he's generally the fulcrum for their play. So, I've got a good. Look, gut can bring you into.
What's
into
your gut? Gut's all the same.
My gut is saying,
no glory, lads.
I'm going to be laying Manchester City tonight. I don't think Manchester City are going to win tonight. You know what happens over two legs? I don't know, but it's difficult to keep the run going. There's a lot of matches they've been playing, a lot of matches, and I know they're in form. I'm worried about like players like De Bruyne. Sergio Aguero will probably be back tonight. It seems like he's been rested the last couple of matches, but there is an intangible, and the intangible is the circumstances, the new stadium, the fact that Tottenham have been a little bit.
Is it automatically positive though? Why is it not take them a little bit of time to acclimatize the new surroundings?
The energy inside the stadium. And I think this is an experienced Spurs team. People talk about the young talent in the squad, but it's a very experienced, almost you could argue a battle-hardened Spurs team now, although they're reasonably young in terms of the average age. And I think that type of player, you got to revel in that type of atmosphere. Your home ground
as well. Difficult. I haven't been at the new stadium, but you get that sense of it. Even looking at pictures of it, listening to the players, you get a bit of a sense that there's going to be that type of energy there. And if the Spurs players can kind of feed off that, and say staying away from that, I know they're the kind of intangibles that we're talking about, just slightly swerving it back again to the teams. I look at Spurs and find it very difficult. Put your strongest team out, I look at Spurs, no obvious weaknesses there. You could argue the same for the top four or five. Get your strongest team to pitch, there's no weaknesses there. But as good as Manchester City are, I was at Manchester City Fulham a couple of weeks ago, I was sitting in the stand watching the game, and they're reasonably strong. If Fernandinho didn't play, but it was pretty much the strongest team. But Otamendi played right side of a defensive too. And every time I watch them play, and he's in the team, and Otamendi's not a bad player, he's a good player, international, etc., etc., etc. But he is an obvious weakness in the Manchester City team. That is an obvious, as good as they are, they could end up winning five, the greatest team in the world. They could end up doing it with a lad at centre-half who can really be exposed in 1v1 situations. And the Fulham did it on occasions. Fulham didn't play particularly well, didn't really hurt Manchester City. But if you're going to get it against Manchester City, if Guardiola elects to play, he doesn't have to, Stones is back fit now, but if Nicolas Otamendi plays against Tottenham in either one of those games, for me, that is a red flag straight away. That's going to be the whole conversation in the Spurs dressing room immediately before the game. When that team sheet comes in and Nicolas Otamendi's there, the talk's going to be, let's get at him. Whether it's Kane, Ali, whoever else, let's get him down that side of the pitch. Let's get on his shoulder because he's rash. He's not particularly quick on the turn and he'll give up chances. So if you're asking in terms of weaknesses, Manchester City, Nicolas Otamendi takes to the pitch in any one of those two games, that is the Spurs in, and that could be the difference over the two legs.
Okay, well, we'll know an hour before kickoff.
Yeah. I you know, the way that the stadium has been described by the people who have been there is that, you know, the seats are very close to the pitch. They've got a really strong kind of Dortmund-style south stand with 17,500 fans. And I just think generally, if you look at Anfield, if you look at Manchester United on a European night, you do get that feel. Now, I haven't played the game. Kenny's played the game. He might have obviously a better view than I will. But I do think that's going to inspire the likes of Harry Kane, Christian Eriksen, Dele Alli. This is what it's all about. This is what they live for. Champions League quarterfinal. This is what Spurs have been aiming towards for years. I was at the last 16 game against AC Milan in 2011, the last time we were really at the stage of the ballpark. They got to the quarterfinals, thumped 5-0 over both legs by Real Madrid, but it was a progression, it was a novelty, right? Hearing the Champions League music at Tottenham was an absolute novelty. That was, what, 8 years ago under Harry Redknapp. Now is expectation. Now there's a new stadium. Now these players, if they can't lift themselves, now they haven't been able to lift themselves for Southampton and Burnley in recent weeks, but if they can't lift themselves for this, then they are being very Spursy. And also, they played very well against Liverpool.
Go on, John.
Come on! They played very well against Liverpool in the second half. And they played very well in midfield, and they probably should have won the game. So, on their day, Spurs are capable of beating anybody. Just over two legs, I'd be a little bit worried.
Do you think they're going through?
No, I need to see the teams.
Okay.
But I am so...
Going back.
Hair's breadth between them. And that's generally hasn't been the talk, is it? People talk about Manchester City, yeah, Spurs, yeah, whatever, decent team. But yeah, Manchester City are going through. I'd say it's slightly different. I think it is that close, and it'll come down to those small little margins in terms of team selections, etc., potentially even over the two legs.
If City don't, that is a bad outcome for Guardiola. It's a bad outcome.
Well, he's still got the charity shield to, you know, fall, the community shield to fall back on.
Every year he doesn't win the Champions League is another year of his career wasted, because, you know, he's supposed to be the singular talent who has changed world football, and the whole point of being the person who changes world football is that you win the biggest competitions. He's had everything in terms of money and finance and the apparatus of the club put in place with the express goal of winning the Champions League, and every year he doesn't is a failure. As he would see that, he doesn't think it's been a great year if he wins the league again this year. He's gone, well, that didn't work. What am I going to do different next year?
Yeah, there's always that lingering thing with Guardiola a little bit. I think there's a bit of substance too in terms of his success at Barcelona in terms of Champions League victories. Yeah, look what he had to look at the players he had available, the best players in the world. Messi, obviously, but in terms of Xavi, Iniesta at their very peak, etc. So that's the argument there. Now, I think that's a little bit unfair, but you have to manage that, you have to coach that, you got to tackle yourself.
Has he been able to replicate it elsewhere? He didn't really, at a Champions League level, he didn't at Bayern at a Champions League level, he had a Manchester City at a Champions League level, he's done everything else, but at a Champions League level, like, the tactics have not worked.
So he hasn't done it, you're right, at Bayern Munich with inferior players. Now, other managers have won a Champions League with inferior teams. Mourinho done it with Porto.
Inter Milan.
Exactly. So other managers have done it with not the greatest players, but they've clubbed them together, they put something on the pitch which has worked, and they've found a way through. He wasn't able to do that with Bayern Munich. And a Manchester City, now you wouldn't say that's an inferior Manchester City squad. He's gone and spent big.
Yeah.
Now, if he can't win that big competition with the resources available at Manchester City, that argument is going to continue, maybe even grow a little bit louder.
Yeah, he needs to win one for himself to feel like it's been a successful season. And it might not be this year. If it's not next year, then that's when all of a sudden that relationship, you begin to see some kind of fracture in it. John, you're feeling confident?
It's not going to be this year, is it?
I'm feeling confident about tonight. Yeah, I don't think we're going to lose. I really don't. And I think the Spurs are a good team away from home, that if we do get something tonight, you know, as Kenny says, it's up for grabs.
It's game on.
And
Let's leave it at that.
I'm waiting. There's always that lingering disappointment which comes.
Oh, don't finish on a negative.
But it's 33 years, Kenny. It's 33 years, Kenny, of disappointments and being like, the human mirage, Kenny. And the water's there, it's in the ground, and I'm going to go and drink, and then it's not there.
Negative vibes, John. I would have streamed your speech into the Spurs dressing room up to about 15 seconds ago. It's going, it's just car crash finished.
Fergus O'Dowd, the chair of the committee which the FAI will sit before tomorrow, will be on OTBAM tomorrow morning. Here's a clip from last night as Dan McDonald discussed the latest documents released yesterday evening. Have a look.
I mean, the most significant aspect of the correspondence and of the statements today is this new piece of information that it would appear now that members of the FAI board, concerns were expressed at an FAI board meeting last Wednesday evening that some press releases issued did not accurately reflect the board's level of awareness of the existence of the €100,000 loan to the association in 2017. Yeah. This is Donald Conway in his letter to Sport Ireland, but that line, a version of that line, was also in the press release today. So again, we have this...
And it's in his opening remarks.
It's in three different places almost. Yeah. So what we... Which now leads to exploration of these previous FAI statements too. And the extent to which the board were fully aware or, you know, on top of every missive that was coming out officially from Abbottstown. So I'm almost imagining people listening to this or watching this and sort of thinking just all these names and stuff that's been thrown at you, and what does this all mean, and what's this all about? And I'm conscious, even in terms of writing it, that it's as much as if you have a knowledge of the subject, you might follow every twist and turn, but maybe people just tuning in from the outside, like, what the hell is going on here? So, but to me, that is the most remarkable aspect of this, there's statements casting doubt on previous FAI statements.
Yeah, that seemed definitely to be the thing that struck everybody yesterday when the correspondence became public between the FAI and Sport Ireland. As I said, we'll have Fergus O'Dowd, the chair of that Oireachtas committee. And in fairness, we were very sceptical about what job the Oireachtas committee would do last week when they had Sport Ireland in, but they changed the style of questioning so that it was question-answer, as opposed to the grandstanding, which we'd seen under the previous version of that committee. So they've made progress, and it looked like they had a lot of work done last week, so you would hope that they'll have a lot of work done for this week as well. Now, we want to move on because... a couple of tweets from a friend of the show, Des Curran, caught our attention over the last while, and this was in connection to one of the issues that we cover a lot on the programme, and this is the behaviour of parents on sidelines when it comes to underage sport. Just going to read these tweets out for anybody who's listening to us on offtheball.com. Two forgettable experiences at DDSL under 10 games this weekend. Managers refusing to give decisions against their own teams. Hearing from players what was said on opposition sideline. 9-year-olds accused of being too soft, and the list goes on. Win at all cost mentality alive and well. And then my assumption was that those coaches would have done child protection and welfare courses to affirm that at this age, it's all about creating a safe and happy environment for these kids to play in. But that all seems to go out the window when the whistle sounds. Des Curran, good morning to you. How you doing?
Morning, Joe. How are you?
Yeah, good. I'm not surprised to read these tweets because we hear about it so much. But when we saw them, we figured we'd just try and get an opportunity to ventilate this item because it's something that always... rings a bell for a lot of parents. You go to matches and you're always kind of looking over your shoulder going, is that, did I really hear what happened there? Tell us a little bit about your experience. What happened?
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to say it was an eye-opener, but, you know, and to a certain extent it was, but, you know, you hear stories, and some of the responses I've received over the last few days, you know, and it's not just from, you know, parents of kids involved in the DDSL, but further afield as well. I mean, we've had, you know, a very enjoyable season so far. I get to most of the lads' games, you know, when I can. So we're about 4 or 5 weeks into the season. There's been no issues whatsoever. And it was just two games, one Saturday, one Sunday. So he plays a Saturday team and a Sunday team. And the Saturday team was a home game. And it wasn't any parents. It was actually coaches. And there were three coaches on the line of this opposition team that arrived. And there were a few, you know, tackles went in the game. And, you know, you're sort of standing on the sideline thinking, oh, maybe that's a foul there. The big issue here is there are no referees at under 10, or in certain leagues there aren't. So there's kind of an honour system between the coaches where if one of your players fouls one of theirs, you're the one who calls it, and vice versa. So you were just relying on the coaches to have, well, what for me would be the maturity level. I know you can get wrapped up in a game, but to, you know, to say to your own team, well, that's a foul, that's their free. So as the game was going on, this obviously wasn't happening. And I think over the course of 50 minutes, there was one foul call by the opposition line. Now, you know, people might say I'm being a bit naive or a bit soft here. So we kind of brushed it off, and the two coaches got into a bit of an argument at one stage, and our coach went over and apologised and shook hands afterwards and said he was out of line. There was no apology, from what I understand, from the other side of the line. And then Sunday we moved on. We were playing one of the bigger Dublin clubs, if I can put it that way, in an away game. And the same thing happened all over again. And you're just walking away thinking, my fellow was very upset in the car coming home. And there was one of the young lads, one of his teammates at one stage in the middle of the game, just asked his coach, you know, why isn't that a penalty? And the coach has to explain, well, they have to call it. So the young kid looks to the line, to three coaches standing there, and nothing. And, you know, you're just wondering, you know, these kids are going out and they're training maybe twice a week and they're playing to certain rules and all this kind of thing. And then this thing happens and then they're left questioning what's going on. Now, when referees do come in at under 12, there's going to be that confusion now, because if they feel there's certain things they can do and get away with. I mean, they are nine. And, you know, if you think the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree, that was the expression I was left with on Saturday, because some of the players were reacting in a manner that the coaches were allowing them to.
What were the players doing?
Oh, there was just what I found out afterwards. There was a lot of accusations being made on the pitch. Now, in the Sunday game, there was one of the lads who was called a diver. Now, if you can tell me that there's a 9-year-old who would prefer to throw himself on the ground than actually score a goal when he's got a chance to score a goal, I think you're living in a different world entirely. And there was criticism of young lads, 9-year-old lads, based on how they looked. And, you know, I got a tweet from someone who was involved in a different league, and he said one of his players, a young lad with red hair, and he could hear parents from the opposition sideline calling him Bosco and things like this for the entire game. Now, you're thinking these are grown adults, men and women, and they're getting embroiled and involved in this kind of thing. You know, you'd wonder exactly what's going on. I don't know what the solution is, but if it's not clamped down in some way, be it through the line or through something else. Now, someone also said to me, look, you can't be praising kids all the time as coaches, you know, because they have to learn at some stage. But you also think, you know, what's going to work better? Are you better off screaming at an 8-year-old because he didn't run back? Are you better trying having an explanation with him, you know, as how he could do it better? The two best underage coaches I've seen in the last few years, you wouldn't actually hear them on the sideline. And still they get their message across, and still they go out and they play football and the kids enjoy it. I just don't see a benefit. I do think there is this thing as well, from what I've seen anyway, that maybe it's a badge of honour for certain coaches or certain clubs to be playing top division, and they don't want to be seen to be losing games. It's not meant to be about winning and losing at this stage. There are meant to be no scores kept. You know, players obviously know if they've won or lost games, but that's not what it's meant to be about. The whole thing is you do, as I said, these courses where it's about creating safe and happy environments for kids to play in. And Albert Byrne, who many of you might know, was involved with the league a long time, the Electricity League, he'd sent me a message saying, look, this can't be just a box-ticking exercise to say, yeah, we've done these courses. When the game comes, it's an entirely different situation.
You talked about the two best underage coaches. What was the characteristics of those guys that made you think this is good coaching? And I kind of understand now what good coaching looks like as opposed to the stuff that you would have seen last weekend.
Well, again, one of them was involved with the club my son plays, and he's since moved on now. But I never heard him shout. I never heard him roar. Now, he'd get stern every now and then, but there's a way of imparting your message. You see other guys screaming and roaring at kids on the sideline. Now, I've yet to see many 8 or 9 year olds who will respond better to that than they will to a little bit of encouragement. You can still get the same message across, but there's a different way of doing it. But I just think now it's this win. You have to win. You have to win the game. And you see poor kids. I don't think there are kids enjoying this game as much as they used to. When I was playing way back in the day, you know, we didn't have a league until under 12, so we came in and there were referees straight away. And I think that solved a certain amount of it, because if you take the decision-making in terms of what happens on the pitch away from the coaches and leave it with a referee, granted, he'll make mistakes every now and then. But that's one part of it at least removed as to where there can be areas of conflict and where there can be accusations thrown from one line to the other. I mean, understand, you know, generally young lads don't play for trophies and cups and leagues until under 12 and then upwards. But it leaves me worrying as to what exactly comes along when it is meant to be more competitive. Now, the kids will have more of a maturity level to deal with criticism the older they get. But I think when you're 8 or 9, I mean, what do you want to do? You know, you come home after school and you're out in the backyard and you're wearing, you know, whatever shirt you're wearing of whatever your favourite club, and you're dreaming of being something and dreaming of playing for someone. But then you go down and you play in a match, and that kind of thing happens. It'll turn more lads away from the game than it will draw to it, as far as I can see.
What do you think about this, Kenny?
Des, how's it going? Ken Cunningham,
hey,
you well?
Hey, Kenny, how are you?
People wouldn't realise how brutal you are in the old five aside from what I've heard listening to your talk there this morning.
That's hearsay, Kenny, it's hearsay.
No. Look, I find it very interesting. I think you're spot on a lot what you're saying. In terms of the age group of these players, I think is key. You're talking under 10s. Des, I suppose you're looking from a few different... It's the coaches really that drive this, Des. In terms of, we hear a lot of parent behaviour on the touchline. I think for me, that's important as well. That's got to be addressed. Start of the season, for me, that's a conversation that needs to be had between the coaches and the parents, to say, look, this is what we expect of you in terms of behaviour from the touchline. Generally, you know, vocal encouragement for the players is no bad thing at all. But in terms of kind of any kind of overt criticism, just a tone of voice as well, I think is important. Kids that age, there's, and just in terms of what information that you're giving them. I mean, from a footballing point of view, a tactical point of view, shouting information from the sidelines onto the pitch from the parents, that's totally unacceptable for me. So that's one issue in terms of the players, how that's got to be addressed by the coaches. And of course, from the coaches, you got to lead by example. And you've got to behave in a similar fashion. For me, obviously I've got my coaching badges and stuff, and a bit of coaching that I've done, I generally try to say as little as possible on the touchline. And this is a kind of a general thing, depending, not really, regardless of what age group there is that you're dealing with. Because for me, players, kids, whatever age, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18, they've got to learn the game. They've got to understand the game. They've got to learn to make decisions, be better decision makers. And you've got to allow them to make those decisions, even if occasionally they're the wrong ones. They've got to find the answers themselves. So for me, from a coach, I'm more interested in standing on the touchline and being as silent as possible and seeing if the players themselves can resolve problems as they arrive on the pitch. That's part of your development as well, rather than trying to preempt things and shout information onto people. Watch your back, runner, go tackle him, drop off, head it, kick it, tackle. These are decisions which players need to learn to make themselves. This is what will aid the development and make them better players in the future going forward. So that's an additional thing in terms of coaches, in terms of information from the side as well, from a coaching point of view. In terms of the refereeing, I wasn't aware of this. That's an interesting one. I think in theory, that's great, because everybody, it's all about the kids and who wins, does it really matter? Let's do the right thing. But I can understand how that becomes a little bit of a car crash scenario in terms of both sides having to referee from the sidelines. So yeah. I think in terms of having somebody in the centre of the pitch with responsibility to referee the game is probably the way forward. You're probably right, that happens. I remember under 12s, you're right, I was the same. I did play competitive football, I think it was 11 or 12s. I came out of mini leagues and home farm and got into a team, I think it was under 11s, under 12s. And I always remember being their referee in the middle of the pitch. And obviously you needed a certain amount of respect the referee's decision. That's no bad thing. So straight away you're kind of up and running, as opposed to this touchline thing, which for me is not ideal. In an ideal situation, Des, would work, wouldn't it? In terms of the coaches, yeah, you know, refereeing and doing the right thing. But I can if you haven't got those type of people on the touchlines that we're talking about, that's a natural consequence. This is going to happen, and that's not going to help the situation. But the basic points, Des, you're making is absolutely right. And it comes back to, as well, quality of coaching, Des, as well, from the side. I mean, these people on the side, I mean, Jenny, you're talking parents, so you're talking about, you know, fathers of the kids who are actually playing on the pitch. Is that correct?
Well, no. Thankfully, I think based on this season alone, with a few exceptions, I think the parents have been pretty good.
Good.
Like, and a lot of them have been pretty quiet, and most of it has been that what you hear is encouragement. And I have to say, I have a younger lad as well who plays under eight, and the atmosphere in that, I don't know whether it's just that group or the teams in that league or something, is really positive, and that you get encouragement from parents for both sets of kids. And it makes a huge difference. I mean, we had a team that came out here maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago, and they'd obviously played 2 5-a-side games at under eight level. And the opposition had a goalkeeper who obviously wanted to be a goalkeeper in one team, but they didn't have one for the other team. So the coach ends up putting one lad in who had been playing outfield, and you could tell he didn't really fancy it. But he did some good things. And the coach at one point, he made a couple of great saves, and we were behind his goal, and we'd give him a little shout of encouragement. And he could turn around, he was delighted. All he wanted was a little bit of encouragement. But he played one pass out with his feet, which they're all encouraged to do now. And it was intercepted, and they scored a goal. And then you heard his coach. You didn't hear it up to that, but then you heard it. And it was the poor kid's mom was, you know, 3 or 4 people up from us. And you're just thinking, you know, is that something that should be acceptable?
What did the coach say? Sorry, Des.
For the most part, the parents have been good. My issue would be with...
Des, sorry, what did the coach say when the kid was playing the ball out?
Sorry, say again, Ger.
What did the coach say that when the kid played the ball out?
Oh, he shouted at him that you can't do that. And, you know, for the want of a better phrase, he gave him a bit of a bollocking about it. You know, and the poor kid, you can see the kid. I mean, if you're 8, you're going to kind of retreat in a bit. Little then, oh, geez, I made a mistake there.
Very
and then the next ball comes from, what are you going to do now? You know?
That's bullshit.
It is. It absolutely is.
Well, you have to manage.
I have to say, though, I don't want this to be completely one-sided. They had a coach up for their other team who was an older, maybe more mature coach, and he was fantastic. He was up and down the line. Now, I know you're saying maybe the better way to do it is stand back, maybe not say a whole lot, but everything he said was encouraging. So even if he was asking them to do something a little bit better, he found the words to say it the right way that they would respond to. And if it was a slight criticism what they did, he'd follow it up with some sort of positive after it.
Yeah.
You know, that you're doing really well. Oh, just try and do this maybe next time, but you're playing really well. And you can see it makes an absolutely massive difference.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. The environment is hugely important, particularly at the age that we're talking about. I think there will come a point, though, Des, and you probably know it, whether it's 12, 14s, 16s, if you're actually looking to prepare players ideally for the professional game. That's a very small percentage of players, I know, but to play at the highest level possible, maybe you might just have to tweak your approach a little bit, and players maybe will have to harden themselves a little bit to a little bit more of a criticism, not necessarily during the course of the game.
Not at under 10 level.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is the point. So this is all about
There's
good
no
coaching.
There's no player of 8, 9, 10 for me has to play at the top division. If they're good enough, they'll end up playing in the top division.
It's a fair point. And what will help them, of course, is getting good information, good coaching, and being in the right type of environment at the age group that you're talking about. That will all help them.
And not being afraid to make mistakes because you're going to get bollocked by the coach.
Exactly, like, exactly, Ger. Spot on. Yeah.
At some point at 16, you're like, okay, you made a wrong decision there. Would you do the same thing again? As opposed to, that was bullshit. Why did you do it? Like, you want your goalkeeper.
But as I said, the older you get, once you get to 16, most players, you would think most, not all, but most will have. They'll have matured. They'll have that maturity level where they can understand what's being said to them a little bit more. And if it's, as I said, if it's said to an 8-year-old in the wrong tone and in the wrong way, I mean, how are they going to react? For the most part, 90% of them, how are they going to react?
What I will say, Des, Jim makes the ball, they have to allow them to make mistakes. Of course you do. And you don't hang them out to dry. You don't vocally strip them down the pitch. But there might come a time, whether it's after the game, whether it's in training during the week, you might get a moment to take them to the side. And listen, do you remember that moment during the game? And it's how you approach it, Des, like you talk about, your tone of voice, how you get your point across. Listen, you made a brilliant pass just before this, but you remember when you found yourself in this situation, you went to ground maybe a little bit early.
I think
maybe in future, if you just so this even then they're making mistakes. I take your point, but it's important. Have a conversation with them. You point out these mistakes and
the ego,
and that's where the improvement comes.
The ego of coaches is so great sometimes that they think that each mistake is a personal attack on them, as opposed to
that parents are looking at them. It's because reflection, of the coach that the mistake is being made. Exactly.
You're right. Ego can come into it.
That's good stuff. Thanks a million for joining us.
Pleasure. Thanks, Gerard. Thanks, Kenny.
Nice one, Des.
I hope your kids enjoy the rest of their season. One comment on this on YouTube. Pellstar says, the County Down Go Games blitzes have silent sidelines this year. You can actually hear the kids talking and calling for the ball. Silent Sidelines are a great job. They should be rolled out across all sports. If you're a parent or a coach and you feel the need to shout anything at a child playing a game, go have a word with yourself.
Anything?
Anything.
I'm not sure about that, like, absolute dead quiet.
Well, the reason you have it is because people can't help themselves. It's the conditioning people to not be abusive.
Parents are reasonable enough if you know, have a conversation with them and say, look,
generally reasonable enough,
I think it's nice to have a bit of encouragement, but then you're saying basically don't encourage your children, you know, have to make a good pass, don't give. Well, I think it's nice to get a bit of vocal, even not from your own parents, but a different parent, somebody else on the touchline says, oh, well done, gives you a little clap. That's nice. That's a nice thing to hear. I wouldn't be saying, don't cheer on the players, like.
All right. On that note, Kenny, thanks for
the Rattlers. What about the Rattlers?
Definitely have the Rattlers. Kenny will be back tonight to watch some Champions League action in your company on News Talk and Off the Ball this evening from 7 o'clock. And we're live across all our social channels this afternoon. We'll keep you up to date on all the Champions League and much more as well. Episode 2 of our Game of Thrones podcast with Andy Lee, Off the Wall, is going live later on today. Owen is up the north with Tommy and Sue and Andy bringing you Game of Thrones podcast. Where are you in the season? Are you up to speed for the grand finale?
No, are you talking grand finale Game of Thrones?
Yeah, it's the last season.
Oh no, I wouldn't know. I've fallen off the. You know, I haven't been following the last couple of years.
That bandwagon.
Very interesting. Owen, he must be able to. He'd look great in a bit of a Game of Thrones costume. He put a bit of the latex all of the. Can you see him a Game of Thrones character?
Yeah, yeah. One of the woodland imps.
Yeah,
yeah. On that note.
Ouch.
Not one of the nice guys.
That's with no makeup.
Nice watch.
No makeup on.
Yeah. Hey. All right. That's it. We're back tomorrow at 7:45. We'll see you then. Good luck.